Restaurant Unstoppable, episode 1071, with Shui and Corey Wong.
I don't think you should ever, ever start with a brick and mortar. That is just stupid.
Are you ready for it factors, success stories, failures, and bombs of restaurant industry knowledge? Then join Eric Cacciatore and today's incredible guest as they share what it takes to become unstoppable.
This podcast was made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live, where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. To learn more, head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. Imagine you had an employee who never called out, kept inventory in line, could spit out sales and cost data at a moment's notice, and saved you hours of work. You'd want to hire that person, right? Margin Edge is the boost in efficiency you need and doesn't add to your labor cost. Margin Edge is a complete restaurant management software that allows you to seamlessly manage all aspects of your business from one central location. With Margin Edge, you can track food costs in real time, make inventory faster and less tedious, easily cost out your recipes, and get a daily P&L so you always know where you stand. Visit marginedge.com/unstoppable to learn more and to get a free monthly restaurant sales report packed with exclusive industry trends, data, and insights. Once more, that's Margin Edge, marginedge.com/unstoppable. This episode made possible by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable, fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, use cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way. This episode brought to you by Owner.com. Owner.com is the leading all-in-one platform for restaurant marketing. Owner.com powers everything from SEO-optimized websites, direct online ordering, automated email and text marketing, built-in loyalty programs, zero-commission delivery, and branded mobile apps for your restaurant that's integrated right into your POS. With Owner.com, there's no contract, no hidden fees, and nothing to lose. Join thousands of restaurant owners using Owner.com to grow direct online sales, save thousands in third-party fees, and simplify their online ordering presence all in one. Book a free demo today at owner.com/unstoppable and see why owner.com is the number one rated restaurant marketing software. With excitement, allow me to introduce to you today's guests, co-owners of Super Happy Fun Time Group, Shui and Corey Wong. My people, are you feeling unstoppable today?
Oh, I kind of am.
Kind of every day.
Now I am.
Yeah. Yes, we got started. It's been fun. I've been running all over the place the past week, all over the country, and my mind is like mush right now. I'm not going to lie. But I'm so psyched to be here because Irene Lee said amazing things about you. Aww. And even just like sitting at your restaurant last night, I got a chance to go in and grab B-roll and experience the food, the culture you guys have, the people you guys have. Everybody was so nice, and the space was great. The food was great. Everything was great. I can't wait to dive into your stories. Let's get that motivational, inspirational ball rolling first with a success quote or mantra. What do you folks have for me?
I'm going to go first this time. I think mine is like attracts like. And when you say that you really admire our team or we like we're killing it last night, there's not a whole lot that I like about restauranting. But knowing that, in the back of my head, I'm always saying like attracts like, that we must be doing something right to have like such amazing people working with and alongside us.
I love it. What do you got for us?
How stressful being in the restaurant industry is, I like to constantly remind myself that my favorite quote is, you have yet experienced your happiest days.
You have yet to experience your happiest days. So yeah. Let's start with that, and then we'll reflect on yours, Corey. Why that quote? Well, how does that resonate with you?
Well, I think, you know, with life in general, and just especially being in the restaurant industry, you know, you have your up and downs. You know, we just all went through a horrific pandemic. You know, it was years ago, but still feels very recent for all restaurant owners or business owners of in the industry. And, you know, there's been days where it's just gotten to the point where it's so sad and depressing and that you didn't think there was a way out. But you kind of have to remind yourself that, you know, as bad as we've had it through all this, and we're still very lucky to have what we have, especially, you know, with the staff that we have and people that's been with us for years and years. And I just think that, you know, with all the downs, there are updates as well.
Yeah,
you know,
it's important to know that. I feel like it gets easier with time, with persistence, and over time it gets easier. And I think sometimes too we forget how much easier it is, because we're always looking to a new horizon. We're always trying to get to the horizon. Yeah. We get there, then there's a new horizon. We're like, that's right. Where I need to be. And we forget to look back and go, oh shit, I remember when it was way harder than it is right now.
Yeah,
because we're constantly like a frog in like warming water. We acclimate to the new normal constantly. Yeah. So I love that.
Also for us, we opened, and not to jump around too much, and I know we'll get there, but we opened 3 months before that pandemic, so we've never had a normal or sort of easy time that we can reflect back on, because it just always feels like it's a new thing thrown in our lap. So it's like, maybe these aren't our happiest times, but yeah, they're coming, or they're, you know, coming. It's kind of like, could be tomorrow.
It's gonna happen. Echo your quote for me one more time, Corey, please.
I always like to say, like attracts like.
Yes.
So, you know, everything from, you know, flying American Airlines or something, and how miserable people seem. It's like, you know, there must be something wrong, like at corporate, because like attracts like. You kind of get what you give out there. So again, you know, like going from sort of working in the restaurant industry to being the owner of different restaurants, you don't have a lot of good things to think about yourself sometimes, because you have to be the boss. So you're the one that has to say like this or correct that or always those things. But to look around and then see like these happy people that are still alongside you, even when you think you're seeing the worst version of yourself, you're like, okay, well, like attracts like, we're doing something right. Cause at our core, they must still be getting past what I see as like this, like, you know, villain, but there's gotta be something that's keeping people around. So.
And what you're sharing is the biggest reason why I focus on the people behind the restaurants and not the restaurants, because behind every great restaurant's a great person, and your restaurant will never rise beyond who you are as a person. And the people you attract onto yourself will never rise beyond. I mean, you can find people that are better than you, but the higher you build yourself, the bigger, you know, the better you build yourself up, the better people you're going to attract. Yeah. So if you want an amazing restaurant, it all starts with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is a great way to get this stuff started. Thank you. And before we dive into how you got to where you are today, paint the big picture of where you are today. Two restaurants. Food truck, are you still using that?
God, no.
Sold it. Would have burned it if we could have.
Yep, absolutely. I was like, we're either selling this or we're lighting on fire, rolling down the street. Like,
that would have been fun. You guys could have sold tickets then. Yeah,
honestly, could have.
So anything else besides the two restaurants that you're using to monetize, live events, catering, anything along those lines?
We're trying to sort of figure out some of that now, especially with King. Jackrabbit has always been too small of a space and too busy of a restaurant to figure out how to make catering or sort of private events work. But with King and sort of the space we have here and the menu that we have here, we're trying to learn a little bit more about catering and get that like to be a bustling business.
Yeah, we have like a wedding reserved for New Year's Eve. Oh, New Year's Eve, yeah.
Okay. We actually have a round table panel workshop that we're going to be hosting. If anybody's listening to this, and if you guys want to join us, we're going to get some people to do a Q&A around catering. Just kind of popped to my mind. So now we have the big picture. When did you open Jackrabbit Philly real quick?
We opened Jackrabbit November 2019.
Okay.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Five years. Congratulations.
5 years. Yeah. And we're about to, we were mentioning to you before, but we're about to move locations for
That's her.
So we'll see what that looks
bigger
like.
Bigger and better.
But like probably should be right around the 5 year anniversary.
Mm-hmm. And King Barbecue is what? Not even a year at this
brand
point?
New,
brand new. Yeah,
not even half a year.
October 2023. Yeah.
Okay, beautiful. Awesome. Okay, so now that we know where you are today, let's kind of go back. And where does it make sense to start sharing your story?
Honestly, probably in a little place in the West Village of New York City.
Yeah. Are you both from New York?
Corey, yeah.
She's from... Yeah, I'm from Buffalo, New York. Mm-hmm. I guess a little further back then. And Shui is from...
China. yeah, I was born and raised in Beijing.
Okay.
I still have family there. My parents are here. My sister was born here. But we immigrated here in 96.
I was going to say, it must have been a while ago because I barely am picking up on an accent.
Yeah, it's like, I immigrated here in 96. I took ESL classes, everyone, all the immigrants do. And I learned English really fast. It took me like only a year. And then wow. I didn't have an accent at all.
How old were you?
So fourth grade, was at 9 years old probably?
Yeah, approximately.
Yeah, so.
It's amazing how rubber the mind is back then. And just
absolutely.
So I don't know what's not rubber wasn't the word I'm looking for. What's the word? Elastic.
Yeah.
It's
like Gumby.
Just a sponge. Now. It just pulls in information. Yeah.
Well, but I did forget how to write and read Chinese. So that's kind of bad.
Whoops.
Yeah. Whoopsies. We immigrated right to New York. I grew up in Queens, Bayside Queens. And then, I got kicked out of high school in Queens.
Nice.
And
then, there's a story here. Please tell it.
pothead. And, smoked too much weed, didn't go to school. But my mom didn't know that. And I told her that the teachers didn't like me. That's why I got kicked out. But my parents didn't speak English back then, so it was a lot easier to get away with. I don't think she still knows till today, which we're not going to tell her.
Unless she listens to this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. and then I finished my last 2 year of high school in Long Island, New York. And to make up credits for all the classes I missed, I had to take extracurricular classes. And one of them was the school just happened to have a culinary class. And I was like, oh, that could be fun or whatever, and then I think that's also around when Kitchen Confidential came out and by Anthony Bourdain. So I think our teacher had us read that, and I just reading that book, if you have read it, it's like, Anthony made it seem that whole culinary world or like whole industry just from his point of view seemed like sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right? So he was like cooking and doing coke and doing this and that. So you're like, oh, that's cool. I want to party and, meet girls. And so I kind of got into it for all the wrong reasons. And then I went to culinary school at the Art Institute of New York City. It's like an 18-month program. And when I started school there, I took it very seriously and just kind of really fell in love with cooking. It just kind of reminded me of why I also like cooking or eating, just because that's such a family affair for everybody, but for me, especially growing up, my grandma raised me. So so she would cook all these grand meals, and it's such a everyone just gather around to eat my grandma's cooking, or it's like a weekend thing where everyone's there. My mom, my uncles and my cousins. So it's such a huge family thing, especially and then around the holidays as well. So I think I get my sense of love for cooking and creating from my grandma and my mom, because as much as we love cooking, we love the act of feeding people.
Yes.
It's very, very personal.
Can you pick that layer deeper for me? Specifically, what is it about the process or the action of feeding somebody that you love?
I think it's very vulnerable and personal to cook for someone. You're putting yourself out there in one single dish or several dishes or whichever that you created, hopefully out of love. And it's not for me, is every single dish that we cook at Jackrabbit or here at King is something that has a lot of personal background for me, or it's either stuff that's inspired by my grandma or my mom, or it's things that I grew up eating. I just think that, if you to cook for someone, to put your whole out there of just this dish of food to feed someone that you don't know the outcome of how they will like it or not, and just to watch someone eat that dish and have a smile go on their face is so heartwarming. Mm. And that's exactly why my mom, like, that's why I'm chubby, because my mom loves to feed me and Corey. And like, I think her watching us enjoying eating makes her feel very like warm inside. And that's, I have the same feeling when I feed people.
Yeah.
Cause yeah,
also
like,
very fun to watch you eat your own food and to eat in general. Like, I love seeing Shwai taste, we'll put things up for lineup and he'll go to grab a bite of it and I'll be like, taste this for me. And puts, you know, puts in his mouth and his whole head rocks back. And, oh, mm-hmm, yep, yep. And I'm like, but don't you think it could use a little more salt? You know, like it's you, your enjoyment of it starts sort of from like the beginning process all the way to the end. Like, yeah, it's fun to watch you eat.
Yeah, because sometimes it's like, you know, like when I make dumplings, it truly does just reminds me of my grandma, you know, who passed away like a year ago. And it's, I remember as a kid in Beijing, especially Chinese New Year, you know, like the whole family would sit around one table where someone would roll out the dough. My grandma would fill it. And then another person's cooking the dumpling. So everyone took a part of making that one dumpling. So when I make the dumpling now or teaching other people how to make it, it's just all this history behind it that, you know, we don't have children. So it's like passing these things to other people is kind of really, it makes me really happy to still kind of still having my grandma around almost.
I love that. Yeah. I love that. And listening to you talk, you know, just kind of helps me in my mind reinforce this feeling, this idea that I want to get out, that the restaurant industry, third largest industry in the world, mm-hmm. most intimate industry in the world. And it's so connected to who we are as a species,
right,
of this idea of like we, throughout the history of humanity, come together, collect food, hunt food, bring it together, cook it, share it.
Yeah.
And that ability to come together and feed each other and to go further together and be stronger together, to have everybody in the tribe that has their thing that I'm going to go forage. And I know these mushrooms, I'm going to bring that skill. I'm a great hunter, like whatever it is, like the bigger the group and the more powerful you are, because everybody has like this ability. And when you, but to be seen for your ability and to be valued for your ability is, I think, one of the things that drives us in this industry. Because in that moment of somebody eating the thing that you made, you can instantly see their gratification and their appreciation for you and what you did.
Yeah.
I think that drives us.
Oh yeah, for sure. And like, yeah, you have to, if you're a restaurant owner, you really have to do this with a lot of love. You can't do it for the money. It's a complete different result after that, you know, like, but yeah, like, yeah, so I just loved cooking. You know, I loved feeding people. So I got into the industry and just kind of worked my ass off in New York. Different restaurants, nothing, no big names necessarily. But, you know, that's kind of where I met Corey, my wife.
Wow. Nice. Yeah.
Cued that up nicely. Yeah. So 33 years old?
What am I, 36?
36?
Yeah.
Yeah, 36. Oh, turning 37 this year, I think?
My mind. Oh, you know, I'm older. I forget how old I am sometimes. I was reverse engineering it based off, in 96, I was in this grade.
Yeah,
anyway.
I have to. Yeah. I have to math all
so
the time.
So 36 years old. Are you guys close in age? Because in my mind, timeline works really well for me. So
yeah.
You've been like in the industry for pretty much almost 20 years, 18 years.
Yeah, which is crazy. I can't. Like, yeah. Can't even. It doesn't feel like it. My body feels like it, but outside of that, it doesn't feel like I started like, 18 years
ago.
And
how long have you two known each other?
10, 11 years now.
Well, we've been married for 9 and I think we met 2 years before that. Yeah. So like 11.
Yeah.
11 we always years. Forget.
So it's 25 years old you guys met?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So 5 years after college, or 5 years after going to college, approximately, or give or take.
Yeah, college. College ended for me early because it was only 18 months.
Smoking weed again.
I took college very seriously because I have to pay for it. Like, because college is only. I went to college right out of high school, and so I started cooking basically, like, right around 20 years old or 19, 20 years old. So yeah, I've been cooking for a while. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And same thing that Shwai just did for us
you do too, please, Corey.
Yeah, Schwei has a much more beautiful one. Mine's like a little bit more traditionally classic. You know, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, happy. Went to college, Binghamton University, graduated, and sort of immediately knew upon graduation that I wanted to be a writer. So I started working restaurant jobs in order to pursue my passion of writing. Moved to New York City from Buffalo, worked at this restaurant for a number of years and had an on-again, off-again relationship there that I finally had to leave. I went to, and this is why I always say change, you never know what's on the other side of change, because as soon as I left that place, I went to work at the restaurant where I met Schwei. And we just kind of, I kind of knew instantly that this was somebody that was going to be serious in my life from, you know, I was front of the house, so I was just a server, but we were doing like all of the pre-meetings for it. And they were like, well, in our CDC, Schwei makes great staff meal. And so I'm, you know, have always liked to eat. I was like this scrawny little kid that could pack it away. And so I was like, oh, huh, you don't say, it makes good staff meal. And then, I don't know, there's just something about him, but we were dating, I think, within like 3 months. Mm-hmm. And I left that restaurant to go manage a nightclub. And then, you know, he got burnt out and we moved down here. Published my first book right when we opened Jackrabbit. And my mm-hmm. second book came out, I don't know, at some other point during all of this, like when we started opening. I don't know.
What are you writing? Do you mind me asking?
I was writing young adult novels.
Okay.
Yeah, I got picked up. I got the phone call from my agent that Disney wanted it. Like literally our first week on the food truck.
When you say adult novels, what do you mean?
Young adult novels. So like teenagers.
Okay, I was like, what
I write
does Disney
smart.
Have up its sleeve?
Sexy books.
Which I am super comfortable with.
So young adult novels. What is a young adult novel?
So it is for, I guess, I mean, it is for teens. Teenagers and 30-year-old women and up.
I think of, what was that vampire movie? That everybody
that's
loves.
What kicked it off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Harry Potter is basically young adult too.
All the Twilight books kicked it off, but it became from there sort of this whole genre of just essentially like books that have teenagers as the main characters, you know, with every sort of level of complexity of storytelling that you can kind of get into across the board. So mine were kind of all sort of techie thrillers. There's only two, but, you know, very different. But yeah, so that's
and Disney reached out to you.
Yeah.
So you got some talent, lady.
Well, thank you.
So are you still writing to this day on top of everything else?
I am still writing to this day.
How?
I don't know.
Not as much as she
like not to. As much as I like to or not. But yeah, still, I don't know. You give me a goal or you give me a deadline or, you know, I very much get things done.
Corey doesn't
so
sleep.
I will like find the time. And also since it was the passion of mine, I wasn't going to sort of let that go just because what I ran two restaurants.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I would love to talk about time management with you at some point today.
Okay.
And how you balance all of that, because I think there's got to be some lessons in
there. I was just talking to Schwei about certain things in like a management level that we need to have some conversations. But it was like, if someone says something, like, you know, I had a few things that got missed that it was like, just do it right then. If someone said, can you ask Corey this? Just text me immediately. Don't write it on a list of things to do and get it done later. Like busy people, you know, there's that whole saying, busy people are the best people to ask to do things. Because like, yeah, you will get an email back from me as soon as I see it. And people are always like, thank you for your fast response time. But if it lives,
you're ruining it for the rest of us. Because the expectation is that.
No, yeah, exactly. Instant.
I will not respond immediately.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like 5 days later. I'm like, sorry, I was driving across the country. My inbox got a hold away from me.
Well, that's a whole other thing, though. It's not that you didn't want to respond. You just didn't see it. But yeah, otherwise it'll go so far down in my inbox that, I won't remember.
Right.
So it's like, I have to take care of it now. And to me, everything is urgent too. Like I need to do that thing now, whether that's like a self-imposed urgency or not. So
2014.
Yeah.
Approximately when you came down here.
Yeah. Like August 2014.
Okay.
Yeah.
2014. Any key lessons, up to this point, 2014, transformative lessons, aha moments, key parts of your story that would benefit the listeners? I don't want to skip over anything.
I think, I honestly do think, especially with our situation, our whole, you know, moving down here, opening restaurants, opening a food truck, I do wholeheartedly feel you have to kind of go with your gut a little bit. As obviously a lot of things are unforeseen and you might not know the outcome, or, you know, because when I got burned out in New York, I got burned out. I was like, I can't not be here anymore. I worked too many hours. I was drinking an amount that was very unhealthy. And so I got to the point where I was like, I need to leave this space or I'm probably going to kill myself. And, you know, we had a friend, Eric Milley, who was down here already. He was talking about opening a restaurant, and he said, oh, you should just come down and help me open this restaurant. And we've never been to Charleston before that. I've never thought in my whole entire life.
A little different from New York City.
I will live in the South. So, you know, I was like, okay. I just said, okay. And then next thing you know, like, we sold everything. And here we are, like, almost 10 years later.
Which is why Millie was shocked when we arrived. And he's like, you know, that's really delayed, right?
Yeah. So, you know, we didn't know what would be like down here. We didn't know what the living situation would be like down here. We didn't know if we had a future or not. It was all very temporary. It was like, oh yeah, we'll probably just be down here for however long and then see where we go next. But, you know, making that making that move without thinking at all, basically, brought us here today.
But I think there's something to be said about going and cutting your teeth in a city like New York or Chicago or Los Angeles, where, like, the standards are through the roof high, the competition is through the roof high. And when you acclimate to that level of having to deliver and work and execute, and then you take that level of excellence and you take it to a smaller market like Charleston. Charleston is an amazing food. It's not like there's no competition in this city. Yeah, let's be honest.
For sure.
But, like, if you were to take that to, like, an Asheville 10 years ago or today, those cities like Dayton, Ohio, or like all these like emerging like mid-level cities that are like that were once booming and everybody left during like the industrial age, like the bones are there, you know, and there's opportunity there and people are moving away from the city. If you take that skill, you take that level of operation and you go to those cities, like the sky is the limit.
Yeah, absolutely. Like. And, you know, not to play devil's advocate, but also at the same time, the amount of effort on your part to survive in New York is also high, which is also how we ended here, right? Like
do it while you're young, right?
Yeah. Well, when I was CDC, you know, I got one speed, is on or off, you know? So when I started cooking, all I did was I worked. That's all I did. I didn't go out. I didn't go out anywhere. Didn't go hang out with friends. I didn't go see my family. I put my head down. I worked as many hours as they would give me. I did any job they gave me, which is how I got promoted so fast, you know. And then towards the end, when Cora and I were working at this restaurant together in New York, my last job before I left, I was probably working, I don't know, 65 to 70 hours a week, like just ungodly hours. And, you know, being so stressed out and overworked that, you know, I had to go drink after work, and that drinking led to depression. And the depression led to suicidal thoughts, and which is why I had to leave. So, yes, you can't, like, I can cook probably circles around a lot of people down here because of where I came up in the industry. But at the same time, that industry almost ruined me.
Well, and that industry, I think, is changing now, too. I think it's lucky that we got to sort of walk the line of both, that we both experienced, like, the big party days of New York and what it was like to be in restaurants back then.
Yeah.
And now, you know, like, our managers don't have more than, like, a 45-hour work week or 4-day work weeks. And, you know, like, line cooks come in and they only want 30 hours. And you're like, well, how are you going to get by on that money? Like, it's a very different time. It's interesting to see both.
There's a shift happening for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's funny because as you guys are coming up through the industry, it's around the same time I started this podcast, 2013, 2014.
Oh, wow. Yeah, wow. That's crazy.
And I remember just talking to these people. I got inspiration for my podcast by talking or listening to podcasts about, like, entrepreneurs in, like, the tech world or just, like, the digital world or people making money online, passive income. And that was kind of how I got the idea for this podcast. And I wanted to recreate that entrepreneurial podcast for the restaurant owner. But then I started talking to restaurants, being like, oh, inspirational, motivational, going to the best restaurants in the country, and they're going to have all these secrets, and they're going to be like, here's my success. Then you start talking to them, and they're like, I'm not making any money.
Right.
But, yeah. But you got a James Beard Award. Yeah.
Doesn't mean shit. Yeah.
Oh, well, maybe I'll talk to the Michelin star chefs. Maybe they figured something out.
Yeah.
their operational costs are even higher. Yeah. So like, and like they're just abusing people. And I got started getting to the point, I'm like, how the, like, what the fuck is, do I still do this podcast? Like, is it hopeless? And that's why my mission over time evolved to inspire, empower, and transform the industry, because it was a collective sick industry, and it's gotten better in the 10 years I've been doing it.
It definitely has gotten better.
Yeah. Cause you know, not to toot our own horn, but people like us who have been burned out, who open restaurants, who do not want our staff to be treated like we were treated, you know? So we're trying to create a better industry just by doing that, like treating our people. Like, that's what matters the most, right? We can sit here today, talk to you while our restaurant's still being ran. Like I'm still there without having to actually be there, because you have to treat your people well. That's the most important part.
Absolutely. Yeah. Before we move on, I do want to ask you to get a little bit more vulnerable and just basically like share, like, what was it that was happening in your life where you felt like it wasn't worth going forward? Like, bring us to like the thoughts you were thinking and the feelings you were feeling.
I think it's just, yeah, like the amount of hours that I worked in, you know, cause I would probably, I think I would start work around 9 AM. And then my day would end around 1 or 2 AM. And then it took me, like an hour and a half to get home. I'll sleep for 3-4 hours, get back up and go back to work. And that was 6 days a week for a very long time. So on top of being tired, not sleeping a lot, you're working your ass off. Like, you're not like I'm going there just like scrolling around.
But you're telling us what you were doing, but what were you feeling? What were the thoughts you were having?
So like on top of that, like, you know, I was underappreciated where I was. So it wasn't like, oh, hey, you're working so hard, good job, blah, blah, blah.
You weren't getting to see people eat your food.
No.
You weren't getting the cookie.
Right. And then I was just working my ass off, underappreciated. And then sometimes being told you're in a bad job where you're trying your best already, but there's no one to help you at all. So you're just kind of feel like very lonely by yourself. You're overworked, you're underappreciated, you're underpaid. And then you couldn't talk to anyone about it because no one was listening. So, you know, besides being tired, I just started getting anxiety about all the, I was
alone in your head.
Yeah. Am I actually doing a bad job? And, you know, I'm working so hard, and why am I still doing a bad job? And like, who do I go to find help where I couldn't find help? So I felt helpless. And so just all those feelings started building up. And then of course the drinking didn't help, because the drinking would make you just exhalate all those feelings even more. Yeah,
escaping the emotions.
So then, like, you know, when you're drunk, you have unreasonable thoughts as well. So like, it's gotten to the point, like, you know, where it's like, well, if no one gives a shit about how I feel or what I'm doing, then why am I even here? So it's gotten to the point where it's like, oh, well, if I'm not here, then, and no one gives a shit, then what's the point of being here? And I can just 86 myself now, and no one would care.
What was the tipping point for you? When did you start to realize that there's, that it's, I feel like when we're younger too, our foresight is so short distance. It's just like, there's life beyond this. Like, there, if this isn't for me, I can get out of it. Like, I'm not trapped here. Like, we get so like in a little silo of like, this is all I have. This is all I can do. So what changed for you to say like, this isn't the only option?
Honestly, that restaurant we worked for, it shut down. Because I was kind of like a blessing in disguise, right? So I wasn't, obviously, I don't quit. I don't quit things. That's not what I do. So I was going to work there till I don't know when. The restaurant shut down because it wasn't successful. And it's so funny, the owner gave jobs to every single employee there except for me. Because they said, oh, they couldn't see me grow there anymore, which is fine. At that point, back then, I was very hurt because I'd been with the group for a while then, like by 5-6 years maybe, just constantly, you know. So I was very hurt and like, oh, you know, I worked my ass off for you guys, but I have no future here. But then, you know, that brought us down to Charleston.
Well, I was going
to
say, one of my big takeaways from like our whole career is that every time we've seen something as a negative or it feels like the door slammed, the rebound of it has been what propelled us to the next level. So like, you know, you sort of were let go and you didn't have a career there. And he was like such a company man. Like he fully drank the Kool-Aid, and I still think it's crazy that they let him go. But then it forced us to like move someplace else. And then when we got here, we thought we had jobs and we didn't because the restaurant was delayed and men don't communicate. So we didn't know that till like literally we had a lease on an apartment, and then that forced us to open the food truck. So sort of all the pivots we've made are things that seemed at first like negatives or like, oh my God, what are we going to do?
Wait, who let you go?
His restaurant group.
In New York.
In New York.
So they fired you.
They fired me. Yeah.
What was the reason they fired you?
Because the restaurant closed.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So, they had like six other restaurants in their restaurant group. So everybody else got shuffled around to new positions. But they just didn't happen to have one for Schwei.
Yeah. Got it.
Which again, like, you know, I was hurt back then. But now it's like, as soon as we left there and drove down here, it was like a huge relief.
Right.
Like, oh, it's literally the best
thing that's ever happened for and to you.
And inspire, empower, transform, right? This is the inspire part.
Yeah.
You can be 26 years old, a young, handsome guy with amazing teeth, by the way. You have great teeth. And you could think that the world's coming to an end.
Yeah.
And the truth is, like, get out of your fucking silo.
Yeah.
There's life after this. There's life beyond this.
Yeah.
If you're not happy, do something about it. The world, there's infinite possibilities. Just keep going.
And
it's never beyond control.
No, absolutely. Yeah. There's always someone out there who is willing to give you a hand or help you to change your life. You know, like we can't pick the life that's given to us, but we can pick to make changes.
Yeah.
I think also now being on this side of things too, seeing how hard work does pay off, or how like people come through our door all the time and into our lives, and you know the hard workers, and they're the people that you want to help and that you want to move ahead. And, you know, I'd say it's like, what, like 8% of like everybody is, you're like, oh, you're a worker. And it does get you places, you know, like you never shied away from hard work. And I think that like speaks for itself, sort of like where you've gotten, like it's, yeah, nothing was sort of handed to you either. Like who were the people that necessarily helped you? Like, I think you also just extremely helped yourself.
Yeah.
Or it's me.
Yeah. I'm loving the conversation. We're going to take a quick break to thank our sponsors, and we'll be right back to dive into how things started to change when it came down to Charleston. This podcast is made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live, where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. Everyone who attends this live event will get a recording of the Restaurant Systems Pro 4-day How to Run a Profitable Restaurant from Soup to Nuts recording. This event costs $2,500 to attend live, and you'll get it for free. Head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. That's go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. Picture this. It's the end of the month, and you're working your way through a shoebox full of invoices and manually entering costs into a janky spreadsheet that is being held together by bubblegum and prayers. And after hours of eye-stabbing tedium, you realize that your numbers don't even match. Oh my God. We've all been there. But it doesn't have to be this hard. Margin Edge can free you from spreadsheet hell. That's because Margin Edge is a complete restaurant management software that automates invoice processing and shows you your food costs and labor in real time. Just snap a picture of your invoice and Margin Edge takes it from there. Margin Edge will process your invoices automatically with line item detail and combine that information with sales from your POS to give you real-time reporting, including a daily P&L, up-to-date plate costs, and updated inventory count sheets. Stop spending hours to get numbers you're not 100% confident in when you could spend minutes and have accurate, real-time food and labor costs. Visit marginedge.com/unstoppable to learn more and to get a free monthly restaurant sales report packed with exclusive industry trends, data, and insight. We're back. And before we dive into you guys coming into Charleston, I really want to get into your head, Corey, because back in 2014, you and Shui are like, you know, you're in love, like you have this plan to be a writer. He has plans to work in restaurants. You're working in restaurants, but are you like, I want to own a restaurant someday? Is that in the cards for you?
No, with that on again, off again boyfriend, I had thought about opening up a nightclub. So I think I try to tell myself I had always planned to do some kind of, like, I always was meant a little bit for business, but no, I just wanted to be the most successful author.
Was it going to be a young adult nightclub?
Yeah.
18s.
Wow. Wine coolers.
No, it wasn't. But yeah, so when we started the food truck, it was just sort of out of necessity, because at that time, you know, Charleston was still paying $9 an hour for things, and we come down from New York, and it's like, we're just done working for other people. But I hadn't planned to start a business that consumed literally every single second of my waking life, and started at 5 a.m. in the morning because we had to make all of the rice, and rice takes forever to make, and we only had, what, 2 rice cookers at the time, so... So you're washing rice at 6:30 in the morning, just being like, this is when I should be writing. So I spent the food truck years feeling really resentful of the food truck, but still, you know, persevered and sort of kept on writing. And I think it was like, yeah, a resentment that kind of drove me, fueled me.
So the resentment fueled you to get beyond it so you could do what you want. So, yes. Because your love for Schwei was so strong.
So strong.
But get me into your head today, though. Just like, help me understand, like, today, do you want to eventually transition out of restaurants, or are you in it now?
I think I'm very in it now. And also, it's one of those things that you always look at where you would like to be, and then you actually get there and you're like, oh, this isn't so great. Like, it's not really that gratifying to be an author, and you're kind of just a, you know, another product on the shelf. And you would think like, well, I'm the author, but then it comes down to it and you're just like a release date that, you know, that gets pushed along. And if you have big sales, maybe that's one thing, but I had, like, you know, fine sales. And then the pandemic hit, and then my second book, Disney sold all of their authors to Little Brown, and, you know, like, there's always been these things. So it was never quite as enjoyable as I thought it would be, or as much of a success as I thought it would be. And at this point, I don't know. So I've moved kind of past like all of those like younger versions of myself that expected a lot more out of it. And there is something, I can't believe I'm saying this, but like gratifying about owning the restaurants and feeling like you are good at this thing that you are doing.
I think we all want that. We all feed off of being seen and valued for the thing we do. And when you are good at it, there's no better feeling to be recognized and to have your lane, to have your spot in the tribe.
I think Cora is also an excellent writer, but it's like any art industry, right? Like there's books, music, food, art, whichever, there's so much competition, and there's always like a click, right? Like, these are the cool kids that hang out together and we write these books, and then like it's just very cutthroat versus like,
well, I think there's a lot of things. Like, I would like to say I was a cool kid in my writing group. I was cool kid, but like but yeah, the industry doesn't really care that much. I think at the end of the day, it's still about like what's selling at the moment and like who's selling it at the moment.
Very transactional.
Mm-hmm. And sort of all of that. So, yeah.
So back to 2014, wow. You guys come to Charleston. Mm. You're like, we have a plan. We're out of the trap. We're out of the city. Life is good. There's opportunity on the horizon. You get here. Men don't communicate.
So we didn't realize
the job that you thought was lined up was not even anywhere ready to receive you.
Yes. Yeah. Right. It was delayed indefinitely, the job that we had, just where we were told. And yeah, it came as a shock, but also like, I guess, yeah, we got a little worried because we didn't have jobs.
Yeah, we looked around and just didn't want to be working at any of the places we sort of could, or making the money that we could. Yeah. And a friend said, you know, you should just open a food truck, kind of offhand, on this property I have. And we thought, well, why not? We weren't food truck people. Like, we still aren't food truck people.
I think we would be if we had money to buy a nice food truck. We bought this tiny-ass trailer that was 7 foot by 14. And I could barely stand up in it. So I had to, like, you know, like, spread my legs so I can just be shorter.
How much money did you guys have when you came down here?
I had zero.
No.
He had zero. I had about probably $100,000 in my savings account. Because when I was in New York, I worked 7 days a week between a restauranting job and I worked at a literary agency. So
you're working two full-time jobs?
Two full-time jobs.
And you put away $100,000?
Hell yeah. I'm a very good saver. And I'm very cheap. So everyone else would go out for their shift drinks at the end of the night or like you know.
Me, yeah.
And
did
they'd be getting
like...
No, it only looks like I did.
It looks great. I love it.
But I did the shirt underneath. Okay. It was definitely a hand-me-down. But yeah, everyone else would be like spending their money on like brunches and food and drink. And I would have like my like well vodka. You know, I have always been very stingy and taught to save. So I like saved a bunch of money. And
what is your process for saving? Give us a lesson there.
It's a lot of self-denial of being like, mm-hmm. I don't actually need that thing, or I don't need to buy that coffee when I can make my coffee at home. And then just like, I have money coming out of like our paychecks that goes directly into the savings account. So it's almost like it doesn't exist in this world.
So is there like a percentage? How do you figure out, is it like do you allocate into a savings account? Is it just a flat rate that you put into a savings account?
Like, it's a flat sum.
Okay.
It's sort of what I looked at. I think we need to get by on, plus like an extra $100 for some takeout food, and then the rest of it just goes to savings. Like our CPA was like, "You guys save a lot," and I was like, "Yeah."
What percentage of the income you make would you say goes to savings?
Oh, I would say over a quarter, maybe under a third, but like probably around a third.
Wow, 33% of all the money you take goes into savings.
We've gotten very good about, oh, we don't need that. Like, especially stuff, because stuff is just junk that you throw away.
So you take out all of your liabilities, all like school loans.
Which neither of us have, luckily.
So what are you, like, what are the liabilities you were working with to give us an idea back then?
Oh, back then? I mean, that was the thing, right? Like, we don't have debt. We don't have credit card debt, and we didn't have student loan debt. So it was...
All of your money was going towards cost of living in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
So like rent. Phone bills,
and we also,
bill,
I was always probably. Weirdly lucky, and I paid $800 rent in New York from the entire 10 years that I lived there, no matter what apartment
$800?
I was in. $800? Yeah,
$800. Was your apartment stingy too?
And the first place included utilities.
It was, very small
it was a basement apartment with no windows, but it cost me $800.
But you're never home when you live in New York City anyway.
Well, exactly. So,
you're
I mean,
just,
we also kind of like...
You're just going to bed. You don't need light.
The first
apartment I ever lived in on my own in New York was $460.
Wow.
It took me 2 hours to get to work, but it was $460. I was also, making $9 an hour.
Yeah, you were making $9 an hour, which is what Charleston paid when we first moved down here. It's crazy.
Front of house servers making a little bit more money in New York City.
Well, So I had a salaried job or like a better hourly job at that literary agency. So I like either lived on my tips and I just pocketed like the other salaried job.
But I think there's a huge lesson here, like $100,000. Like savings is so important. I think that... American culture in general is just so lavish. Like, I need the new shoes. I need this. Right. I need the designer that. A new car and all these different things that will make you happy for like a day.
Yeah.
And then it's just another way to get to work.
Shwai and I drive a tiny little Kia in a van that his parents gave us. And again, we're very lucky in the sense that they gave us a van. But even now, like opening Kane and reopening Jackrabbit, we are using like our savings and our good credit to get us through. Like, we've never had investors because every time we've tried, it hasn't worked out. And we kind of got creeped out by it. But, you know, like, I can't say enough about savings. And we offer 401k plans to, like, all of the kids that work for us. And it's the same thing. Like, even when things are extremely tight, like, we had a big downturn the last 6 months, and you're kind of eyeing all these things you could cut back. And it's like, wow, I'd really love to not be matching all of these IRAs. But I'll still send emails to be like, hey, I noticed that you haven't started your, like, 401k with the company. You're leaving money on the table. Like, please, like, we would be giving you an extra 3% match, but $35 extra a week that you're just letting hang there, and this could be building something for you. It grows.
Right. But like, just the power of having your own cash, whether it be to invest in assets to create opportunity for yourself or just to be a security net when you think you have a job waiting for you and you don't.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, like my dad always told me when I got my first credit card ever, my dad told me, don't spend any money on that credit card that you can't pay back on your savings.
It's same. Just the payoff.
Yeah. So it's like,
Spend money, pay it off.
Don't have $600 in your savings, don't spend more than $600 on your credit card. So that has always been
great advice.
Yeah. And that's the same. Yeah. Very, I was raised up sort of the exact same way, which is very lucky for us. I think it would be very hard. Schwei was a little bit more spendy when I met him. But I've always controlled the purse strings. So, but luckily, you know, like, yeah, we're very similar in a lot of ways. And that's luckily one of them, because I think it'd be really hard to be with somebody that, you know, you have made me loosen up and like finally enjoy the money I am spending. But yeah.
But I mean, I think one of the biggest lessons I learned, why I want to put emphasis on this, is because when you're getting started, it's not about trying to go out and make money. It's about controlling your liability so you don't necessarily have to make a lot of money early on.
Yeah.
So you can, if you keep your liabilities as low as possible, if you have savings put away, you might need a year runway of cash in the bank to just get that to that point where you're in the black. Yeah. So don't focus so much on like, how do I open and how do I go get loans? So like, start small, let cash flow determine your growth. And it sounds like that's what you did.
I mean, I think that's what we did. And that's why I wonder if we're like messing up a little bit now, just because we have used now all of our savings and leveraged it into getting big loans and credit and moving Jackrabbit. We don't have the savings account anymore because it was all spent on King, but
it's an asset.
But yeah, and which is how I don't look at it, because I just look at what like I can actually physically grab.
But you own you own most of the assets, or do you get, how much are you comfortable talking about how much you had to get up for a loan? Actually, we're getting kind of out of order right now.
I love specifics.
Okay, we're going to get into the specifics. but first, let's go back to 2014. Let's follow this timeline. So you're here, food truck trailer is where we left off.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the first time Corey and I have ever had to work together. Well, you know, besides the restaurant we worked together in West Village, it was the first time we had to work together as a team for the same goal, because it's our business. And everything till then, Corey hasn't really seen the side of me where I'm like super stressed out in the kitchen during work. So, you know, it was a very small trailer. So Corey sat on a bucket at the...
How many feet long was it?
So it was 14 feet long. Okay. And all the equipment was in there. And
what
I couldn't...
were you cooking?
The food truck was called Short Grain. It was kind of our take on like a Japanese rice bowl truck.
Okay.
So we had like kirage and like a sashimi bowl. And so there was like a little fryer on there, a little flat top, and our rice warmer. And we would crank out like a lot of food for a tiny trailer.
Yeah.
But it was very small and we had no air conditioning. So I don't know if you've ever been here in the south in August, but very unkind.
It's and March it, like, never, and 70 degrees out. It's awesome.
It never occurred to us to like get fans to put in there. Or like it was like the second year they were like, hey, we can open this back door and put in a fan. But it just worked under like the worst conditions.
Corey took all the orders. I cooked everything. So just us, you know, when we go to office buildings, and crank out like so much food, but I would be doing it by myself, and you know, doing that by yourself and trying to keep up it gave me so much anxiety that
I can imagine,
you know, that and Corey would get stressed out because, you know, like there's so many orders on coming in,
so many orders, and then I'm just sitting there staring at the tickets and he'd be like, stop taking orders, and then you're staring at the 25 people standing in line in front of you and you're like, 1 second, guys.
So, you know, like, so there was just butting heads for a very long time, and we didn't really know how to deal with that because it's something so new to us in our, as a married couple in a relationship, that we haven't ever, type of stress that you don't really deal with on a daily basis as a married couple.
Well, and also we literally, just gotten married. Yeah. So we had like a nice honeymoon phase of dating in New York, but that was even short. Got married, opened a food truck, and right away it's like this wall of stress, like operating a business, it takes up every second of your life.
Yeah.
But it leads us to like the second thing, which is like get help. You know, like we hired somebody and immediately... and this is probably a year and a half in or whatever, but it made everything.
A year and a half in, you hired your first person?
Yeah.
Wow.
But it made everything like so much better because you're afraid, you know, it's me and again, I'm cheap. So you're looking at the numbers and you're like, well, how can we afford to pay someone XYZ? But then you do and it's like, it just opens you up to do like so much more business because you now have help. And I mean, at that point too, like, our relationship needed saving.
Yeah.
So it was worth every penny we could spend on that person.
So.
But.
The first year, it sounds like you guys were gangbusters. If you have a line of 25 people, you already have more orders and you can manage.
We were the first food truck. And granted, at the time, there was like seven of them in Charleston. But the first food truck to get a proper restaurant review from the newspaper, which led to someone from Bon Appetit coming down and then putting us on the best restaurant list. Wow. So we like
as a food truck,
as a food truck. Yeah. So we got like we were gangbusters out the door because we had such good press. So it was there was no like growing into it. It was kind
were
of
were you
like,
making money?
Yeah, I mean, we made enough money to save up that helped us open Jackrabbit.
How much did you save? You came down with $100,000.
We came down with $100,000. We spent $40,000 to open the truck.
That's not bad. I mean, that's the cool thing about food trucks is that the overhead relatively is so low compared to a food truck.
Because no employees. You rented a space for a commissary kitchen, which wasn't big. And then
kind of live off of the tips that you're getting, as your day-to-day.
But you're in a tiny-ass trailer.
And you kind of hate each other.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you had a commissary that you were working out.
Yeah, I think cost us, $650 a month?
Yeah.
That's not bad.
Other than that,
I feel like Charleston relatively was less expensive then than it is now.
Oh, it was much less expensive.
Yeah.
So you're doing rice, which is great margins, so great value, perceived value in rice because of volume, right?
Bellies. And I did all my own prep work. So, labor. I mean, there's no labor cost because I'm doing all the labor, for prepping food.
What percent margin were you making on there? Sorry, I cut you short, Corey.
Oh, that's okay. I don't know if I'm going to be able to remember or if I even knew back then.
Did you know what you were doing in terms of like menu engineering and like who was like the, I mean, you're clearly good with discipline and saving, but did you guys know what restaurant numbers were, prime cost? Were these things like on your radar then?
Not at all.
I'm not sure that prime cost is still on my radar.
Yeah, but it's so funny. Like when we first opened ever, like our first day on the truck was like, the only spot that we could find was this, where was it? Oh, that furniture store, parking lot of the furniture store. And it was like 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. something
like
that.
Oh, it'll be a great late night spot.
Yeah. And then I think we made like $50 that night.
Wow.
And then, there's days like that. $50, like, wow, we made our first $50. And then, when we first started, we were making like $200, $500, and it's got more and more. But
towards the end, a good day would be, a day that we wouldn't go out for anything less than was like a $1,200 day, but we could be making upwards of like $2,800 a day.
And you're talking about $13 rice bowls.
As many as we wanted towards the end, which was like one.
That's kind of the cool thing about a food truck too. If you're doing good, you can kind of I don't feel like working today. We're not going to take the truck.
Or you close towards down the end, for all of August and you just go see family.
Yeah.
Towards the end,
were doing, I think two or maybe 3 days. And then we would take August off and we would take December off.
Nice.
Which was insane,
So you're able to put $40,000 aside. You're able to cover all of your liabilities. So was that $40,000? That's not including like owner's pay. That's just savings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That we put aside or that we put into it?
Well, you're putting money aside to save, but you're also able to cover your lifestyle too, is my point.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You're doing good money with it. So it's possible. I kind of assume, like, if you're listening to this podcast, I hope you know how to fucking cook, right? Like, I'm assuming the food is good. But what gets people in trouble is all the other stuff you have to be good at that is just off the radar. So what were the other things you were good at in the early days beyond the amazing food that you were cooking, Chui?
I think being who we are and being very personable very helped a lot. People really liked us because we were all, like, always, like, just kind of cheerful and fun and quirky. I think that helped. And then, being very good as important as it is now, it was important back then. Like social media is actually very helpful. Being very good at being on social media is very good for the business.
What was working then, is that still working now or has it changed?
I would say like
still helps.
We got our new location, or we're moving Jackrabbits to a much better location, and it's like a hot spot in town and everyone wants to be there. And we ended up getting it, I think, just because of our reputation. And people will always comment to us about, well, you guys have such a good reputation, which I don't know. We just are us and we live in this town. But for whatever, saying the thing about being nice, I think that carries through. And we've always just kind of been geeks. Like, if we like a spot, like, we're going to be there all the time. We're going to tell everybody we know about it because it's the very best thing. And I think other people then, like, feed off of that excitement because it's genuine. So, it's like be friendly and, just kind of be genuine. And it has really, really, really helped us in Charleston.
Yeah.
Nice. So 2014, 2017, 3 years of doing the food truck.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you stop the food truck to do a pop-up?
It was literally just very unhealthy, I think.
Yeah, we couldn't do it anymore. Yeah.
For us mentally, for us personally as a couple. And then just, yeah, like I was just, it's so hot in there that like there was days I had to like sit down before I passed out.
Right.
We'd been looking for a restaurant space since we moved to Charleston and found out we didn't have jobs. We'd been looking for a restaurant space from the get go.
Yeah.
I think we've literally been into every available building in the city from, you know, like
I think, yeah, the food truck
14 to now.
For being how small the food truck was, we just realized it really limited us to how much we can actually do, you know, beyond rice bowls. And also, you know, like Corey said, like restaurant was always our end goal. And we decided that, yeah, if we don't sell this food truck right now, then we're always going to have it to fall back on.
Mm.
But if we sold it, then we have no other options to go back on. Like, we have to. We did the pop-up just to make money. And that just while we're doing pop-up, we're looking at every single location we can find.
Got it. Yeah. Before we start talking about pop-ups, because this is a hot topic, if I'm opening a restaurant tomorrow, I'm starting as a pop-up.
Yeah.
That's what I'm doing. I'm doing one thing really well, and I'm starting as a pop-up. I'm testing different markets. Yep. I'm testing recipes.
Yep.
I'm collecting. This is where I think a lot of pop-ups go wrong. I'm collecting emails and contact information so I can bring my tribe with me. And when I am ready to open my brick and mortar, I already have 10,000 emails to start promoting and marketing to.
Right.
Get those emails. Start building that like beyond social media. TikTok might go away tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly.
Literally.
Yeah.
You know, like own that list. It's so important. But along that line of like great advice for food trucks, things that you wish you knew in 2014 that you knew in 2017 that you could give or forewarn somebody looking to open a food truck tomorrow.
I think people open food trucks because yes, it does cost a lot less than opening a restaurant. You know, like we spent $40,000. That's, you know, it was buying a truck to drag our trailer plus, you know, whatever equipment we needed, blah, 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 so on and so forth. And I think everyone sees that food truck's doing well. Like, oh yeah, I can do a food truck. You know, I make a good hamburger. I can totally do a food truck. With the world that it is today, with the amount of competition there are, like Corey said, when we moved down, there's only probably 7 food trucks total. Now you look at Charleston, there's dozens and dozens. You have to be very unique. You know, what makes your food truck stand out more than anyone else? Sure, you're doing a corn dog. Maybe your garnish are different, but at the end of the day, it's still a freaking corn dog. You know, you have to do something that's so unique that's going to make you stand out.
Yeah, you have to fill the food, a hole in a the
void,
food scene
yeah.
somehow,
yeah.
Which isn't always easy because maybe your hamburgers aren't going to fill that void. So does that mean you don't open the food truck? I don't know, like, but maybe you don't.
And I will say, for what we have gone through personally as a couple, that if you are going to work with someone, especially your significant other, you got to make sure that relationship is strong as hell.
Well, you're still married, so I'm assuming.
Yeah, strong as hell.
Yeah. So, you know, we gotten to the point where we're like, there's shout fighting and just all this. Just we fought a lot opening the food truck. You know, after we got out of work, this just be constantly fighting. We got to
the point. I don't know that it was constantly fighting. We are not. I wish it was constantly fighting. We're very good at angry silences, which I think is the thing. Like, I didn't know how to express. I grew up in a kind of a very you're mad at someone, so you silent treatment them for 3 days. And Shui, like,
you're saying women don't know how to communicate?
Crazy.
zing.
You know, and then Shui will like sort of like suppress his emotions and then he'll just go silent. So it was like two horribly upset people like silent in the same house together. But, you know, like, that's part of what I love about our relationship and sort of this whole process is that we've, like, kind of figured out how to talk to each other and how to actually listen and not just talk at each other or be like, well, I feel this way. Like, yeah, that's nice, but it's also about how the other person feels, but actually genuinely caring because, you know, it'll make you both feel better to, like, listen.
Yeah. So how have you gotten better at communicating?
Well, like, you know, from... I think the biggest lesson I learned working together is that you really have to have patience for your significant other, especially if you're working together. Like, you have to have the patience to listen. You have to have the patience to not just say whatever the hell's in your head. You got to work and think about, what I'm about to say to this other person, is it constructive? Does it make our relationship better? Does it make our end goal better? instead of just something out of anger or out of whatever, that you're just saying things that are spiteful. Mm. You know, so being patient with each other is huge.
This always makes me laugh. This is not the first time that Shwai said that, and I'm always like, oh good, the way that he learned to deal with his relationship is being patient with Corey.
No, it's also, it goes back and forth, you know, like, yeah. Corey has to learn to be patient with me, because, you know, when she's seen me in the kitchen when I'm frustrated and I get hot-headed and then I just say things and do things I don't mean, that is, I turn into this person that I don't want to be, you know, because I'm so either as tired or frustrated or have anxiety about it. You do these things, either you're slamming things or throwing shit away or yelling at somebody. This is a chef that I never wanted to be, right? And Corey had to learn how to be patient with that and learn how to, you know, to calm me down so I'm not that this horrific human being that I don't want to be, you know, like, or like me being like patient with these issues that I've been having and not just reacting on my feelings. Mm. You know, so it's a lot of that.
I think my thing would have been that we don't absorb each other's stress, or trying not to. You know, like, we're like, I would get stressed out about something, and then that stresses Shwai out about something, and I'm like, no, I didn't need you to also be stressed about the same thing. Like, I just needed to vent about it. Like, it's hard when we don't have family here, and we do have friends, but we never see them, so we're like each other's sort of everything. So when one of us is in a bad mood, it does affect your whole environment. But there's also, I feel like you've gotten so much better about like acknowledging that I am the one having that stressful thing, and like trying to help me see around it instead of also just getting equally stressed about it. Whereas before, it would be like, we would just poof, and then we're right back to like nuclear.
So it sounds like the big lessons I'm pulling is like, you know, first seek to understand.
Yeah.
First to really listen. And then once you fully understand, and also encourage the communication.
Yeah.
But the most of communication is listening. Yeah. And then I guess like just encouraging each other to talk more often.
Yeah. And stay in the room, I think, too. Like, you know, we could be mad at each other, say sort of zaners, and then leave, or just get frustrated with the conversation and like end it. It's to stay in the room and get past where you just feel like you really scored one today. You know, it's not about that. It's about getting to the other side where you actually fix the problem. Right. So now we'll both feel kind of frustrated with each other, but like, I won't go and fold laundry and he won't go outside to do what, you know, like we'll kind of stay there and like it's you feel like you're taking a physical step past it, and sort of some of that stress immediately falls away. Like, okay, now we're back to being sensible adults that we can like fix this. Like,
yeah, communication.
Like, what are you actually saying? And let me help us get through it.
Yeah, communication is key for sure.
Love it. So let's shift to pop ups, and we still have two restaurants to talk about.
I know. Oh my gosh.
So well, I'm loving the detail though. Yeah. So 2017, 2019. You said something earlier that I think was really important. You said a couple of things that I kind of want to resurface. One, you hired somebody that was at the food truck.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But do I really want to go back to the food truck? I think it's important to talk about like why it's like, at first you think I can't afford to hire somebody, but then you do it. And then what happens?
Well, what happens, and to sort of bring it back into the restaurants and sort of more present day, is we've taken this advice from our good friend Marijuana and Molly Irani out of Shai Panee Restaurant Group in Asheville. And they always say, you know, like, in order for your team to grow, like, you have to step away from things. You have to hire the people. You have to let other people take over for you. Maybe it'll be like 80% of how you would have done it, but that's still better because you have to be the one that's driving the company forward. And the only way, you know, you have to like promote from within is to like give them more opportunities to promote too. So it was kind of the same thing with the food truck and hiring that person. It let us, not quite the same, like we weren't out opening more food trucks because of it, but it let us operate easier so that we could have the energy to like to go into opening the restaurant and doing other things.
Yeah. Everything you say yes to is something else you have to say no to. Saying yes to a responsibility, a role, a job is another opportunity that you can't pursue because your time and energy is being sucked up.
Right.
It's a never ending process of building layers between you and the thing that your business does. And the most successful restaurateurs just figure that out, and they're constantly figuring out the next thing, delegating it, figuring out the next thing, delegating it, until they're at 30,000 feet with 20 people between them and the thing. And it's just that hierarchy. And as much as we don't like hierarchies,
well, or then you get important. So removed from it that maybe that's when like you know, you are too big and people do start to leave the group because you're not the same mom and pop you used to be. But there's got to be like a happy medium there somewhere too, I think.
Well, I think that that'll round back to like trust it likes, right? You need to find the right people to lead the team. You got to find people that are exactly like you to lead the team, not someone who's going to change the whole culture.
Yeah.
And I think, and then go back to like hiring our first person for the food truck. I think that's the first time we ever, I think for me at least, like I learned that, yeah, you have to, well, we could put that money in our pocket and still be stressed out. Or we give that money to someone else that we hire to make our lives less stressful. All right. So this is kind of like where we got, you know, opening Jackrabbit and King was that, yeah, we need to just hire more people. Like, yeah, like how much money do we actually need in our pockets? Because, you know, at some point we kind of figured out, oh, like, yeah, personal life, the wellness of our personal life is way more important than just putting more money in our pockets.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's a collective, like, a collective awakening that's happening in the restaurant industry right now. I think it happened with talking to Irene Lee, with Maymay, talking about, she's like, we do open book management. I'm like, how much has that increased your profitability? She's like, honestly, profit, not a lot. But the quote unquote thing she said was, but we're able to do a lot more cool shit for our people. I think I might be paraphrasing that, but with like, so you're now able with the additional or the additional cash flow able to do things like insurance, 401k or like whatever that might be, profit sharing. Like, so you're able to use the extra revenue to attract and keep better people. And then when you do that, the sky's the limit because it just kind of momentum takes over and like you start to scale.
Yeah.
Right.
Because all this extra expenses can just literally just be put in back in our pocket. And we don't have to offer health insurance. We don't have to offer IRA. We don't have to offer like 2 weeks pay time off. Like,
if you want the right people, you do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, like, or if we don't want to be in the restaurant every single day still hustling, then yeah, you need to hire these people.
Right.
Your personal time is also very important.
Yeah. You said something else earlier, Shwai, that was interesting. That, it was $40,000 like to start your food truck.
Yeah.
And I don't think you said something, maybe I'm imagining this, but how much does it cost to start a pop-up?
Nothing.
Oh, zero.
$0.
How much does it cost to print menus?
Maybe $10,000 for like the immediate things you get to take with you. Like, you know, if it's like a special piece of a, you know, if there's something that you're doing, like say you're doing pizza and you're doing like a mobile, like you bring your own oven with you, but you're using other people's restaurants to prep and stuff like
that. Well, that's true. Like, we had all of the things from the food truck. So like all of our rice coolers and cookers and, you know, like, we were able to carry everything over.
Well, you know, through doing the food truck, we met a lot of great industry people like chefs or owners and built really strong relationship with a lot of people on Emmons Oats and is one of them, you know,
past guest in the show.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. He's out.
Oh, fun. Yeah. So, yeah. So, you know, they've been like, we wouldn't be where we are without them, you know? So you built these really strong relationships. So yeah, we just go to these pop-ups in these different restaurants, them being one of them. And, you know, you don't have to have much to, you know, to cook out of there because they have all the equipment and
And it was, you know, like invaluable because initially we were going to open something that resembled some kind of an izakaya, you know, like short Korean was untraditional Japanese cuisine, we called it, which let us do everything. And through the pop-up, you know, maybe the first pop-up was that, but then like almost immediately Shwai just started cooking Chinese food. And suddenly, you know, it wasn't an izakaya. It was like this family style Chinese restaurant based off of mom and grandma's recipes. And it only developed because we had the time and space to play through that pop-up.
Yeah.
And the same thing, exact same thing for King. We started doing pop-ups again at Edmonds Oast Brewing Company again. And, you know, what we thought was going to be sort of like a spin on barbecue with kind of Asian-y sides, you know, became like legit like
Chinatown barbecue.
Yeah. Chinatown style barbecue, using Southern smoke.
So along that line, the question I asked you before with like the three things you knew before getting into like things, you know, after doing a food truck that you could pay forward to the next generation, what about pop-ups, things that just aren't obvious that are, is good advice if you want to do a pop-up?
I think, you know, same thing with having a food truck, you know, be unique, but also I think just be true to who you are. Like, don't make things, that you think, well, it's, Don't ever cook because of money, right? Don't like, oh, hey, this town is missing spaghetti. So I'm going to make spaghetti, but I don't know how to do it. I don't really like it, but I just want to do it because it makes me money. You know, I think one of the biggest successful part about Short Grain and Jackrabbit is literally just food that we truly, truly love or that inspires us. So I think that naturally just stood out.
Right.
Because it was something that that we loved and did well because we loved it. Not something that was unknown. And think that really just attracted people. Oh, you're making this food that no one's ever had before, but you're also doing it well. So like, if I was trying to cook Italian food, it'd be really disgusting. You know, so
no, which, be fair, it would be fine.
So one thing I'm curious about, I'm sure my listeners are curious about, is if you're looking to do a pop-up, how do you approach restaurant owners asking to use their space, and are you sharing revenue with them? Get into like the I guess appropriate way to share and do business with people letting you do pop-ups in their restaurant.
This is where the geeking out over places that you like thing kind of comes in, because we sort of just relied on all of the friends that we had met through being customers. So to start that from scratch, I guess I would start looking at places that, you know, are closed a few days a week, or that have like a similar ethos or ethic to you. You know, it doesn't need to be the same style of cuisine. It's probably better for the restaurant if it's not, but you know, like, I don't know. We always went to we never went to like the bigger restaurant groups. It was always, again, sort of little mom and pops like us. And if they also happen to use like local and organic produce, then all the better, because like we also share that kind of thought, you know, it's like quality food coming out of another quality food kind of place.
Yeah.
Is that helpful?
I don't know.
So just networking and developing relationships.
I think networking is very hard. You know, I still do it, you know, like till this day. You know, doing all the wine and food events in all different cities. You can meet one single person that can change a lot of things for you in your career, you know. So.
Also, I think it was interesting. This is not an Edmunds Oast thing. This is sort of elsewhere. But, you know, when you start doing that pop-up, you get asked to do a lot of other pop-ups. And sort of whenever we would, it would be places that you knew kind of were struggling and needed a boost. So it might be like, you know, like, I don't know, places that need a little help or need some of your followers, or, you know, look for mutually sort of beneficial things.
I think alcohol and food goes really well too. So if it's a brewery like Edmunds Oast, or a distillery or a winery, or wherever there's people, if you can find those symbiotic relationships.
And absolutely. Like,
right. Well, and Edmunds, you know, kept their liquor money and we kept our food money, and it was kind of just cut and dry like that. And then they didn't have to staff their kitchen those evening, but they could stay open for service and sell more of their liquor.
Yeah. Like most places that we popped up at, they all kept alcohol sales, which is more beneficial for the restaurant anyways.
So and you're pulling people in with your food and they're selling booze.
Yeah. So it has to be like a give and take for sure.
The year is getting close to 2019.
Wow.
We're almost at the point of opening Jackrabbit Philly. How did you guys come up with that name? What's the story about that?
So in Chinese zodiac, I'm a rabbit and Corey's a horse. So it's Philly as in the female horse. And Jackrabbit just because it sounds nice instead of just rabbit horse.
So I saw Jack Rabbit. I thought it was like a jackass and a rabbit. Yeah. And I was like, what's up with the Philly? So thank you so much for explaining that.
Jackrabbit was the only rabbit that, because we played around with like hare and bunny and
all the different names for rabbit you could come up with. And then, I've always known prior to meeting Chui, I've always known that I'm a horse and felt more connected to that than to being an Aquarius. So it just, you know, we are putting everything into this little restaurant baby. So it's like kind of funny. We named it after ourselves. And then King Barbecue is also named after ourselves.
Yeah.
But you know, like barbecue people like always name their smokehouses after them. So
what part of you are King?
In Chinese, Wong means King.
Okay.
And if you look at the logo for King Barbecue is a tiger head, and, because on the print on a tiger's head really resembles the Chinese writing for king.
Is it a crown too?
So it's like three lines and a line down the middle. That's how you write king in Chinese, and that's how the word king come from in Chinese. It actually just resembles a tiger's forehead because the tiger is the king of the jungle.
Mm-hmm. So it's three stripes, you're saying?
Three stripes and a line down, yeah.
Okay.
And we didn't, you know, and so we're thinking about it because, yeah, you want to be playful and you want to call it like Wang Barbecue, but you don't want everyone just calling it Wang Barbecue all the time. So we knew that was out.
So, yeah, specialize in sausage. Okay, I'm looking up like images of like, I just Google search King Chinese to see like the actual, right? I'm getting a little distracted, I'm not going to lie. Yeah, that's I did look at the tiger's head. That's really cool.
Yeah.
You learn new things every day. So back in 2019, you said you guys were, you're looking at every available property. What was it that you were looking for and why did you, what was it about your current location for Jackrabbit Philly that made you want that location?
We're very quirky in the way that we don't, so we hate new builds. Like we don't like new build out buildings to move into because there's no history behind it. It's just
there's
clean,
no
dry, and
no
yeah,
matter
it's
how
cold.
Much you try to inject.
Yeah. And then, you know, we're also not, you know, having worked in New York for so long that we didn't want to open a restaurant that was kind of in that same environment, right? We didn't want the drunk people. We didn't want the tourists. We didn't want like any of that. We don't want to open till 2 a.m. in the morning because it's all the things that we did that we hated.
So it's not just the physical space, but it's the location of the space.
Yeah, I want absolutely. It to be a neighborhood joint.
Yeah, we always wanted to open, like, my favorite restaurant of all time is Diners. Because it's same. Because the food is always comforting. No matter yeah. which diner you go to, it's always comforting.
There's always
it's not it's not pretentious.
No, it's familiar in ways that you don't even think about. And then, like,
it's communal.
It's very communal. So we wanted to open Jackrabbit. We wanted to open a restaurant that when you walked in, it felt like you were walking into someone's home and having a dinner party. So with that being said, we wanted to open a neighborhood that kind of supported that. And, you know, like as if we were opening something in Park Slope, New York or Brooklyn, somewhere yeah. anywhere in
so
Brooklyn.
So you're like 7 miles out from like downtown
oh, yeah.
Charles.
Yeah. And you know, but, you know, with that being said, we were, yeah, like kind of slightly terrified. Of, oh, no, it doesn't have the foot traffic like downtown does. It doesn't have tourists. So was this going to be successful if we open in Park Circle? And, you know, Spurrell Avenue is where we are. Jackrabbit is now. And before we moved in, there was basically nothing else there. And Park Circle, probably 12, 15 years ago, you wouldn't even go there. That's where you get robbed. So everyone always thought, like, and also downtown, too. Like, downtown, like, if you talk to anyone that's been here for forever, there are certain streets that you didn't even go walk down to, you know. So, yeah, there was definitely like a little bit of fear when we opened Jackrabbit, but we knew that it was the right place.
Was it turkey?
It was not. No. It was a complete shithole.
Start a restaurant was it, in something was a, that was a former restaurant. You say unheard of?
No,
it was a restaurant.
Though. It was called. It was
a nightclub.
Yeah, it was called Deja Vu 2. It's opened by this woman called Rita. It was one of the first gay bars in North Charleston, and from a lot of neighbors who's been there. They say, you know, it wasn't just like a gay bar. It was honestly like a family place. Like people would take their kids there. And Rita apparently had the best wings out of all of North Charleston. So it had like, so many warm history in there that I was like, oh, this is the spot we want to be in. But yeah, it was pretty much, I think it sat abandoned for a while. She had it for, I think, 4 decades. And she, you know, she got older and wanted to not do it anymore. So there was asbestos on the floor. There was a stage in there at one point where the bathrooms are. And yeah, there was just decrepit and it was had to be completely gutted.
So what was it about this place? I mean, you kind of talked about the location, the fact that
it kind of comes down then to like price tag. Yeah. So two things. One is that completely unbeknownst to us, we bought a house right around the corner from it, like literally a 4-minute walk. Nice. So when we looked at this space, we were like, oh God, that's perfect. And it was finally something that we could afford.
Well, how much were you going to buy it outright or were you renting?
No, just for rent. But, you know, the landlord gave like a good like build out package. And it was, yeah, we had a great contractor that like kept prices low for us. I think we spent $40 on the food truck, right? We spent $340 to open Jackrabbit.
That's
which nowadays
low. Insane. Yeah.
It would have been doubled definitely nowadays because everything costs so much
right,
more.
Inflation.
Like King cost us 1.4, just comparative. But we were able to do Jackrabbit with our savings and with loans from like our parents and one cousin.
What percentage of your rent is what percentage of your total like revenue goes towards rent?
Currently at Jackrabbit, it's We have under market rents on both spots.
7-6%?
So yeah, I would say it's like, yeah, probably somewhere right around 7.
Yeah, I think 8 is like the magic number, like, or no more than 12 ever. But like if you can get 8, like that's manageable, at least room for more profit. But if you can get below 8, you're doing something special.
Yeah, yeah, like it, honestly, downtown Charleston current today is just as expensive as New York City.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah. Okay, one more thing I just want to bring to the surface that you said, and I think is really important. I'm going to do my thing. I apologize, but like, I think it's important to echo mission and vision, and that's why we have these things, so we can share them. And what you said, like that community that it's in now, 12 years ago, you'd be shot. People wouldn't go there. It was dangerous.
Yeah.
This is what I mean by the restaurant industry has the power to change the world.
Yeah.
Restaurants go into those communities first, and they are the beginning of the triggering of communities being turned around, because they bring people in and they provide opportunity for those people in those communities that can't go further into the city to get jobs, you know, and it gives those communities a chance to be seen for more than the reputation.
Yeah, you know? I mean, since we moved in, not because of us, well, kind of because we kind of priced ourselves out of Park Circle, but also, you know, talking about, like get in there at the right time, like where around our house, there used to be these giant lots of trailer parks. And it's sad that, you know, the families got moved out, but now there's like dozens of $500,000.
Yeah, homes. I don't think we'd be able to like afford, we would not be able to afford to open our first restaurant in Park Circle if that was today. We wouldn't be able to afford our house if we moved
to Park Circle. The restaurant's always moving first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And good people, good restaurants raise the community.
Yeah.
It's a formula. You see it all the time.
I think you have to be also very careful about, you know, the community that you are moving into. Like such as King, right? We knew this is an up and coming neighborhood. It was a very African American heavy neighborhood. But we opened King with that in mind, not charging people arm and a leg where our neighbors can't even afford the food. Mm. Same thing with Jackrabbit. Like, you know, it wasn't like a poor neighborhood, but it was up and coming. But we also never wanted to open a restaurant that like it was like special occasion only. We wanted to open a restaurant that you can come back to at least once a week, right? So
yeah, like a restaurant for everybody. And I think that was always, that was the mission statement of King, is like, it's supposed to be a restaurant for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, the drinks are like $11 and $12, which I feel like is unheard of in the city nowadays, and still like extremely exciting craft cocktails. Thank you, Amy Calacragas. But you know, we still have a $12 sandwich on, and that's always going to be a $12 sandwich that's like delicious.
Yeah.
But you know, like we opened here because of this neighborhood, not in spite of it. And you almost don't want it to grow too much, but also, you know, every place needs something nice to go to.
Yeah.
So
what were the biggest challenges 2009? Well, I mean, we don't have to talk about the pandemic. We all know that was,
we don't want to talk about that. But too like, much, but
you did have a whole year of operating before the shit hit the fan.
No,
right?
we had three months.
Oh, never mind.
Yeah.
I mean,
it hit in March kinda have to talk and we opened in November.
Yeah. We opened the week before Thanksgiving.
Well, any challenges with opening that like you can pay forward to people listening to this?
We lucked out in that we got 3 months under our belt of sales, and people, we were worried that it wouldn't take off and people wouldn't come out to Park Circle to go to our restaurant, but they did, and kind of in droves, like line from the bar to the door type of situation.
I think, we didn't get that initial, you know, most restaurants like, oh, you have to survive that first year to be able to be successful, right? Having had the food truck and been around with the food truck for so long, and then having had the pop-up to test out our menu for the new restaurant, that built us so much.
There's a lot of anticipation.
Yeah, anticipation for us opening the restaurant. We had such a great following already that as soon as we opened, it was just line out the door. You know, so I feel we got very lucky that way.
It's a cool part about starting small, right?
Yeah,
in developing that brand. That brand recognition will follow you.
I think
so
always
don't start with the brick and mortar necessarily.
No,
start
I
where
don't,
you can and bring the crowd with
I
you.
I don't think you should ever start with a brick and mortar. That is just stupid. Yeah. The amount of money, especially, you know, like who actually owns their restaurants these days, like the physical building itself, right? It's very hard to find places that you can buy now, just because the smart people already bought all those spaces. So they're, most restaurants that you go into are leased, right?
Yeah.
So you're spending all this money, hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars into a space that you do not own. You're upfitting a shithole into a beautiful restaurant, for a space that you don't own, that eventually that you're going to have to give up, right? And so if you're unsure of a concept or whatever, don't starve at a restaurant. Yeah. Don't ever do that. Don't spend that money that you don't have. Because like, I know none of you have that money to spend it on a gamble. Restaurant.
You don't know if it's going to work.
Exactly. Right. So, you know, having the food truck worked out great too. Because one of the biggest part was, yeah, being in the food truck, you drive around all over the city. Because, yeah, we didn't know where Jackhart was supposed to open. You know, so we drove into all the different parts of town and see where the food would work out better than the other places.
Market research.
Market mm-hmm. research. You know, no way to better do it than, yeah, being physically around. Same with the pop-up, right? Does this food work in Charleston? Does this dish work? Does that dish work? But this dish doesn't work. Let's try something else. You know, so we did so much research and testing before we opened Jackrabbit Philly. And I think that helped us a lot. We didn't just have nothing and open Jackrabbit Philly with this whole new menu of no following. Because that, I think...
And I don't know that it would have been, done as well. Yeah, it probably would have been disastrous. Right. Yeah. But we kind of knew that based on, you know, having been everywhere yeah. in the
so
city.
So is Jackrabbit Philly operating today like it was envisioned to operate when you opened in 2019? Or did the pandemic shift that vision?
I think pandemic shook us very hard. You know, we no one knew how to deal with it, right? It was this whole new thing. I mean, I didn't learn how to deal with pandemic in culinary school. You know, when we opened, it was very successful. And when this happened, it just kind of like took it day by day. Almost,
but otherwise, yeah. I think it operates the same as when we opened. But yeah. the biggest thing is we were always going to be no reservations and just a walk-in restaurant. We yeah. definitely don't take reservations. And we have a wait list and it's on pen and paper. And like the first thing we did was start doing reservations. yeah. So we haven't moved
Why
away
was
from
that? What made you realize that was a good move to make?
Gosh.
I think also just remember. With the... You know, that's the goal of Zach to, you know, work in New York or, you know, working at successful restaurants where it didn't take reservations or it was small enough space where like, oh, we only take basically names at the door. And that just didn't work out for Charleston, you know, so we just shifted immediately, like especially after
so it was a cultural.
I think it was you didn't want people coming and waiting in lines close to each other. And we don't really have any waiting room at Jackrabbit. So if they came in and it was like a busy night, like where would they wait? So it just felt like a appropriate way to space people out because we had to, you know, we did the to-go route for a long time. But then as soon as people in Charleston started, like we were allowed to do patio dining, everyone did patio dining and no one wanted to do to-go. So then you had to open patio dining. We were always kind of like running to keep up with what everyone else felt comfortable with maybe versus what we did.
Right.
So when we started doing indoor dining, our staff was like, ooh, and we're like, well, we'll space it. Well, tons of plants in between and reservations will let us pace it out. So it's not just like this influx of people, you know exactly who you'll be getting and how many you serve a night, et cetera. And then we just kind of never shifted back because we got used to it and our customers got used to it.
I think it's a service to the customer too. I got to be honest today, if you're a successful restaurant and you're making people wait in line for an hour and a half, I feel like it's just being inconsiderate to their
kind
time.
Of an F you.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so much, there's no reason for it today.
Yeah.
Like, even if it's a waiting, if you want to do a wait list, perfect. Use an app.
Yeah.
Don't make people wait on the street in 90 degree weather outside if it's cold.
Yeah.
Crammed next to each other, let them get in line on an app.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Like you can still do that, but like it's inconsiderate to the time of your guests, and it's a service that you can offer.
It's not hospitable.
No,
you know, get off your high horse.
Like, yeah, and it makes you look like good. Like, oh, we have this line that never stops. Like, okay,
yeah, it's one of my biggest pet peeves.
If we didn't take reservations, we would make a line happen too. But then, yeah, agreed. Thank you.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's just too much resource today to manage lines and to we all agree. So, reflecting back at your now since 2019, 4 years as a single unit, or no, it was 3 years as a single unit operator. Let's talk numbers.
What was the
peak in terms of profitability for Jackrabbit Philly?
The first 3 months we opened.
Well, I mean, 2022 was really good for us. We were back to full capacity. Do you want to know like specific numbers?
I will take whatever you're willing to get. Some people don't like it. If you're willing to share specifics, it's up to you.
Well, we were open 5 days a week, 4 days for lunch, and just a Sunday brunch that didn't have dinner behind it. And we were doing $2.2 million a year.
How many seats?
68-ish inside and like another like 60 outside on picnic tables.
I think it was smaller back then because we didn't have.
And you're like, what, 8 months out of the year you're at full capacity where you can sit outside probably, is that safe to say?
Yeah, minus like rainstorms.
Yeah.
Yeah, so 7 months out of the year.
Yeah.
So you're doing 2.2 million, 60, we'll call it on average 110 seats?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that sounds fair.
What percent profit are you aiming for? When you're operating on all cylinders, what's your...
Well, someone, we just had a talk with someone who's trying to lend us money for the new Jackrabbit, and they were like, and I was like, I don't know, I think we were like at around 11, and he's like, well, 20 is the thing, and had a catchphrase for, we see, this is why we're bad at it. I just know when we're making money and when we aren't, and since it goes into our pockets, like, into like our bank account, like we make what we make via salary, and then the rest of it just goes into our bank account. And finally our accountant was like, you should probably start like a money market or a savings account, because this is a lot of money to have in your bank account. So we shifted some of it over, but it's not like we ever saw it. But I think we were probably doing, I think we were probably somewhere right around 20% or higher profit in that 2022. Last year we tanked and we were 125% less than we did the year before, because we shifted around the schedule, and I think people felt poor and our staffing costs like went through the roof.
The cost of living in Charleston also went up. So that's something you have to, you know, it went from a really affordable place to live to an expensive, bougie place to live. So as the costs go up, like, you have to share that wealth with your people.
Yeah.
So you lost 22% of total profit or total revenue.
We lost 125% of the profit we had made the previous year. So you figure if we made, say, $250,000 in profit, we lost 125. How does that work? But that's what the Post and Courier said when we talked about it. But no, say we made 250 2022. I think we made like $89,000 profit last year.
Yeah, it was, this is the biggest part of the pandemic, is that most people got laid off because, you know, the government was paying everyone better salary, or the restaurants couldn't afford to pay their employees anymore because they weren't making any money. So when people start going back to the restaurants, start cooking again, half the people just didn't want to work anymore, apparently. So you had especially in Charleston, where, you know, there's less people. It's not like you have hundreds of people to pick from, like bigger cities, you know. Charleston, the skilled employees were very, the list is very short.
I think there's a lot of things that are happening. I do think that what you're saying, there's some truth to that. There's like people got some money from the government and they're like, sweet.
Yeah.
Gonna roll this out as long as possible. But I think there's other variables, like the gig economy really started to take off.
Well, I was
gonna
say, I think
it
was like, do you wanna work in a hot kitchen or do you wanna drive Uber? You know? Well, so there's a lot of choices like that you could, like, people are like, I don't wanna go back and do that anymore. I'm gonna do this other thing that has better hours, pays about the same.
They're forced to try other like alternative sources of income. And then some people were like, well, I like this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they never left. So like the gig economy did fantastic during the pandemic.
Right.
Especially like the shopping jobs where people were afraid, like people who were maybe more high risk didn't want to leave. So like there are more food delivery drivers, there's more shoppers, there's more dog walkers, there's more the infinite a possibility of the gig economy.
Right.
I think this is really when, what else is out there? You have money, people making money online. I think OnlyFans took off around this time too. Did it not?
And then like Twitch and all that, like all this gaming, like, so yeah. So the
influencers.
Yeah. Yeah. That was like, job. But yeah, so like, you know, people that are willing to come back to the kitchen was very, there wasn't a lot. And then so you are now forced to almost, you know, pay the most, more than anyone else can pay just to get employees. So, you know, all of a sudden, you know, your $17, $18 line cooks are now $20 an hour because you had to.
Interesting, because like all of those wages needed to go up. So absolutely, it's like very good that this happened.
It was a necessary evil.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, like, but then, yeah, our payroll costs went from being around like 43% to 72%.
So your prime cost, so that that's your payroll, 72% of total revenue. Mm-hmm. What were your cost of goods?
We've always run around 28%.
So that's good. Yeah. I think it, probably because, I mean, the food you're cooking, lots of flour and rice there. Or flour and water, rice.
Good margin. Not at all, honestly. We're just very good about, you know, we buy everything local. So, you know, our you know, people are paying $2 and change for shrimp from Thailand. We're paying $16 a pound for shrimp that's local.
Yeah.
But it makes a huge difference in flavor, and also you're supporting a local farmer.
Right.
So, but we're just very good about, we're like, everything is in grams, and we're just very, like, I'm very anal about keeping things, and there's absolutely no waste.
So
ever.
Pull back some layers. What is your advice for somebody who's running a kitchen, trying to get their food costs under control, measurements, portioning, get into that?
I think, my biggest lesson that I learned is, literally you have to gram everything. You can't put things in ounces, because, or you can't put things in cups, or like you have to be so precise. You have to be almost. This is what I learned about. McDonald's is a perfect example, right? Because it's consistency. No matter which McDonald's you go to, anywhere in the whole entire world, here, China, whatever, a cheeseburger is always a cheeseburger and always tastes exactly the same, because they have that down, like, packed. And like how much ketchup you put on there, how much mayo, how many pickles, how much onion. And that's what kind of way that we treat Jackrabbit and King, is that consistency. Not only are you offering like someone who comes back, you know, comes to eat here the first time, tastes like that, come back here 3 months later, still tastes exactly the same, but you're also controlling your food cost.
Yeah.
Because every single sauce that you put on this dish is exactly grammed out to be this much.
Yeah.
Right.
I just realized we need to take a break to thank the sponsors. I forgot to take a second break. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, used cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to those messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. RTI's services are not limited to oil. They also provide insurance premiums and automated hood cleaning solutions, plus hood filtration systems, making your hood cleaning process easy, automatic, and worry-free. In addition to all this, Restaurant Technologies, Inc. can help you reduce your carbon footprint, which we all know is becoming increasingly more important to the consumer. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way. This episode made possible by Owner.com. Owner.com is the quickest and easiest way for your customers to order directly from you without the expensive 30% commission fees. With Owner.com, you'll save thousands every month when customers order through your website and branded app instead of third-party delivery apps. And reward your customers with a built-in loyalty program that turns them into regulars who order again and again. Owner.com also helps you rank higher on Google with world-class search engine optimization built specifically for restaurants with an AI-powered website. We cannot forget lists. Build a huge list of people who live near your restaurant fast and market to that list on autopilot with text and email sent at the perfect time to help you grow sales and stay top of mind. Owner.com gives you everything you need to grow and market your restaurant online with no contracts or hidden fees. Visit Owner.com/unstoppable right now to book your free demo and see why thousands of restaurant owners trust Owner.com to power their restaurants online.
We're back. I cut you a little bit short on your advice on measuring out food to the gram, but like, how do you keep
numbers?
So you like, okay, measurements, right? But like, what other aiding material, other things go along with measuring to the gram that help keep consistency?
Yeah, so I think that came about changing everything from ounces to grams also came about from me stepping out of the kitchen, that me now having to be there to keep my eye on everything, and consistency and quality is so high for me that I tell them all the time, like, that's the most important thing for me, consistency and quality. I'd rather throw something out than serve something that's not supposed to be the way it's supposed to be served. So with me stepping out and with like food costs going skyrocketing, like, oh hey, let's gram everything, so there's absolutely no waste, right? 1 ounce of something of soy sauce is totally different than measuring out that 1 ounce in grams, because it's so precise.
Yeah.
So like even like a few more grams you're using than before, a few less grams than you're using before, it matters on your food cost. So yeah, we created like documents after documents after documents of recipe books for sauces, charcuterie, pickles, whatever it may be, just to keep that consistency and that food cost low. And obviously we had to shift certain things, like the rice that we started out with when we first opened the restaurant is no longer there, because it used to be $63 for a 50-pound bag, which is already expensive. But we wanted to use really high-quality rice. But, you know, we've gotten to the point where labor's are skyrocketing. Everything else is skyrocketing. Because, you know, being a Chinese restaurant, everything was imported, or most things are imported. So we had to shift. After the pandemic, that rice that was $63 a bag all of a sudden is $80 a bag.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, maybe it's stupid of us to keep using that, because maybe, like, you know, let go of our pride a little bit and have used something that's more reasonable and smarter, or just not.
And we kept it from the food truck too, that we were always using short grain, because, right, you know, short grain food truck. And then finally I was like, maybe let's just start doing. Well, do we switch to jasmine there?
It's a medium grain rice.
Wow.
But, you know, like, because, yeah, like, just because your food cost went up doesn't mean customers wants to pay more money for it. Because they don't understand that your food cost went up or your labor went up. They don't care.
I agree that they don't understand. And I think that's part of the issue. And this is not my point. I'm trying to be better about letting you guys steer the ship and listening.
You're doing
great. But at the same time, I feel like if we're going to transform the industry, the only way it's possible is if we transform society and educate them and say, this is what the cost of food is.
Right.
And like, do you want to put good food into your body?
Right.
Or do you want to put super GMO, shitty, like not healthy, cheap food into your body?
Yeah.
And like, if you want the good stuff, it costs. And I think that the society just doesn't even know the value of food. Our perception, the value of food has been totally warped over the past 70 years with centralized food systems.
Yeah.
So like, if you want, like, how are we going to switch it back? By educating the consumer on like, this is actually what it costs, and maybe have fewer subscription programs or buy less nice shoes.
Yeah.
If you want good things being put in your
body.
Well,
and our thing too, like, you know, we can say that all day that we like believe in serving good food, which we do, but then he and I will go out and eat like our faces off of Taco Bell, you know? So it's like,
Taco Bell's delicious.
But then it's harder when you
Crunchwrap Supreme.
Yes. When you know all the farmers personally too, it makes it a lot harder to buy commodity when you know the lives that are dependent on you making these choices. So by us making these choices, then, you know, like, our customers are making these choices, and we're all sort of supporting each other.
Transforming
like
the
way.
World.
Yeah.
Well, you know, wow.
Well,
wow.
Again.
Well, I think also people have in mind that ethnic food, Chinese, Mexican, Indian, whatever you want to say, like, should be cheap, right? Because people are used to eating shitty American Chinese takeout, like General Tso's chicken or chicken and broccoli that cost them $9. But what you're
putting, not gonna lie, man, General Tso's chicken.
Yeah, I mean, I love it, but like, you have to realize I'm not using garbage to feed you, and I think people need to get out of that mindset of ethnic food having to be cheap. And, you know, so with Jackrabbit, like, we wanted to be a Chinese restaurant, but we did not want to be a Chinese restaurant that sold things that are just disgusting. You know?
Well, we weren't necessarily aiming for being an American Chinese restaurant either. Yeah. You know, like, I always say, like, nobody else could make this food, because it's like, it's so personal to you and the journey that you have been on. And half of it is things that, you know, like, if Shuai eats something that he finds delicious, you'll see like reflections of that, like, in three different places on the menu. Like, it is so personal to his palate and our palates.
Yeah.
You know, plus like the, like, who has recipes like your mom and grandma, you know? So you're truly not getting this. It's not just Chinese food. You're not
it's
getting
an extension
this food
of who
anyplace
you are.
Else.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to food costs, yeah, like, we buy local and that's expensive, then you have to. So you kind of choose your battles of, okay, this dish doesn't make as much money as the other dish, right? Where we put on a current menu, it has let's see, what's the most expensive thing that costs us? Like our Seafood Delight has lots of local shrimp in there, which costs us, I think, $16 or $17 a pound right now. So we don't make as much money on that dish at all. But then, you know, we have a crunchy salad. Salad always makes you money.
Yeah.
So I think when you write a menu, you have to think about, okay, so I can't make the same profit margins on every single dish. That's just not a thing.
Right.
You can't do it. You know, how much money do you have to charge for this one dish to make that same profit margin?
Yeah.
But, you know, a crunchy salad, a Napa cabbage costs you, a whole case, I think, costs $28.
So, yeah, the items that you can have room to throw a few extra points on in terms of margin, you make up for the less expensive items, making them more expensive, charging for things like the service and the experience, you add the value there, and then you make maybe like a one, like, I don't know, if you're trying to do 15%, like, you make maybe 7% on that instead of
exactly.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Great stuff. So anything reflecting during your success with Jackrabbit Philly in terms of like things you think you do exceptionally well that you can give advice to the next generation? I'm saying next generation. I feel like you guys are just getting started.
Yeah, I know. I do think.
I think we listen to our people. I don't think, I mean, we don't know what prime costs are still, but you know, like, I don't think by any means either one of us thinks we have all of the answers. So when someone comes forward that actually works in your environment and says, hey, what about XYZ? Like, you listen to it, and if it works, you absorb it. And I've, the horror stories we hear of like where people have come from, and like, I don't think Shwai and I honestly do anything above and beyond for our crew other than, you know, just like respect them. But like, I don't think that people get listened to that often, and then they don't feel that invested in the place that often. And so I think like you also, you know, like you make it feel like it is like a team effort, because it is. So, and part of that is like, yeah, like accepting other ideas and like letting people run with things.
Yeah, like we're not so, you know, up in the hierarchy where we're like, oh, we're doing it our way, or there's no other way to do it, you know. Because we're still a very young restaurant group, you know. So there's still so much for us to learn. And some of these people who work for us has been in the industry a little longer than we have, or they have. Or for restaurants that had different work ethics or different ways to go about things, we're very open-minded about all that, you know. So let's take advice from other people as well.
When and how do you take that advice? Do you have time? Is it like, is there a place and time, or do you work it? Is it like, is there a ritual and routine around meetings where people have a way to say something or to be heard?
Well, I think whenever we want to change something drastically, we always talk to our most trusted management team first. And then if that goes nowhere, sometimes, yeah, we like to throw it out to staff. Like, we'll have a, you know, during lineup meeting, we'll be like, hey, what do you think about doing this? What does everyone think? You know, so we do like take sometimes.
Well, and I think it's maybe shifting a little bit now, but since we opened Jackrabbit, I was at the door every single night and he was in the kitchen every single night. And so we really know that team so well. So one, we promoted half of them to open up King with us. And two, we've seen all the people come through. So our crew is very comfortable with us. So I don't know, like it'll kind of be like a flag down type of thing, or like we'll get text messages, or I mean, not so much stuff is in flux, but you know, yeah. We're very good about like being like picking out the heads that we really appreciate and being like, hey, you, like, I know you're so good at that. Like, what do you think about, we're going to try and do X, Y, Z next. What do you think about that?
Yeah. You know, or like, our manager, one of our front house managers here, Ben, he just, you know, last week texted or in the email wrote, hey, what do you think about me dropping off menus and maybe samples to like local hotels or
like apartment complexes where maybe they do like a, you know, like we bring in food once a month kind of thing.
It's like, yeah, like, you know.
So what happens culturally when you take the time to see other people and let them be heard?
I think people are just generally happier, or they stay with you for a lot longer. Why? Like our CDC, Brendan Olson here, has been with us since the pop-up days, you know. He started with me as a sous chef, and now he's a CDC here. I just, you know, like going back to like why one of the biggest reasons why I left New York is that, you know, feeling underappreciated and unheard and felt helpless. I make sure that none of them ever feels that way. You know, when we hire people, one of the biggest things I always say is like, hey, always talk to me first when you're unhappy, no matter what it is. You know, if it is money, if it's hours, if you're feeling disrespected, whatever it is, talk to me first and we will try to fix it to the best of our ability.
Why do you have to open that door? Why do you have to extend that, I don't know if you want to call it an olive branch?
Because...
Is it an olive branch? I get that right?
Some kind of tree. Some kind of branch.
It's a...
Well, I don't, like, it's very important to be seen and heard, because it, again, the only reason the restaurant runs is because your staff.
Yeah.
You know, if their feelings and concerns are not being heard or being fixed and they're unhappy, then you're not going to have a happy staff and they leave, or I don't know, it's going to create a different work environment.
Yeah, maybe in a lot of relationships that you're not used to being so upfront about the things that bother you. So especially in your work relationship, or maybe it hasn't paid off for you to do that in the past, or then you were kind of blacklisted in the past if you like complained about something. Or like, I always tell people, you know, that Shwai and I have had every conversation under the sun and at every tone of voice, and you can't phase us. But then to still hear things like via someone of some person, like, you know, not feeling happy about something that you're like, oh man, we say it all the time, like, just come to us. But it's hard to do that, I think.
Well, yeah, you gotta, that's culture. And I think part of the culture isn't just like saying it once, but it's like living it every day and literally creating that safe space. And one of the reasons why I love EOS, I don't know if you have you ever heard of EOS, the Entrepreneurial Operating System? They talk about it in the book Traction. It's a phenomenal book, but it's called the Entrepreneurial Operating System. And within that, they give you a process for weekly meetings. And within that process for a weekly meeting, there's a time that exists to share and identify issues. Mm-hmm. So you're working it. You're literally creating ritual in your business. And ritual is culture. Ritual is time and space. Yeah. You have to create that time and space for people to get it out. It's powerful. It's, you created the space. You communicated it, right? Which is just as important.
One of my favorite things is our CDC over at Jackrabbit Now. She ends all of her emails with questions, comments, concerns. And that was something that I always said, like, early on, you know, you end every meeting with like questions, comments, concerns, like, now's the time.
That's a perfect example.
And now that it's like carried on, and now she is accessible in that way because, you know, you're kind of like asking for it.
Yeah. Cause let's face it, end of the day, this is still another fucking job, right? We're lucky to have found something that we all love to do. You know, I love to cook, and these kids love to cook. At the end of the day, you're still doing this because you have to pay bills.
Yeah.
You know, you're lucky that you found something that you love to do, but like, at least if you have to work hard and do something that's basically just for money, at least make that work environment a great work environment.
Yeah.
We say that too. Like, we're not a restaurant where you're going to be like whispering in the corner and bitching about work. Like, then don't come to work, or like, don't work here. You know, like, we are happy professional people, and not to be like drink the Kool-Aid about it. But, you know, like, again, like, attracts like, and we tend to, the people that survive with us are the people that like enjoy this work for the time that they're in it, and then go home and do their own exciting lives or whatever. But, you know, like, why come to work if it's just going to be a toxic place? Right. So we try to like, you know, funnel out the toxicity when we see it sort of as soon as possible, so that then you are more comfortable too to like to express your concerns, because you know it's like a precious work environment where it's not normally like this, and we've noticed this, so can we correct it so we can get back to being like that?
Yeah, I love this, guys. $1.4 million open King Barbecue.
Yes, sir.
So
lots of crying.
So I want to just, you know, make sure we cover everything that you've done. So what was the reason for opening a second restaurant? Like, what was the rationale? Like, take us to that point. And how long has this been in the works?
It is, yeah.
I mean, I have a million and a half ideas in my head constantly. You know, we thought about doing a Chinese bakery because I missed that about New York. I thought about doing a raw bar because I wanted to do a raw bar. And barbecue was honestly came out of nowhere, you know, because one of the biggest reasons why we opened a second place, because you have all these good people you want to see grow, but you don't want to lose them. So what do? You can't, they can only grow so much in one small restaurant. Yeah. So it's like, well, we have to open a second restaurant.
To create more room for growth.
Absolutely. Yes. So
The number one reason and only reason, for the record, I'm so happy you're saying this, is to scale. Two things determine it. People. Cash flow. You need the people, and if you don't give the people that vertical ceiling to go somewhere, they're going to go somewhere else. But you also need the cash flow to cover the expenses. So once you get that cash flow, and once you have the people who are like, when you're like three or four people, like layers deep of people, and you're like, that assistant manager could be a general manager easy, and that general manager could be, you know, like, they could run the store, like, like, we got to give them the opportunity, right?
Even currently, like, with the two restaurants, you know, really amazing line cooks over at Jackrabbit, and we're like, you know, one of our strongest line cooks. It's like, oh my God, his talents are being wasted right now. You know, so, so, you know, this barbecue place just came out of nowhere just because Brandon Olson, our CDC, was my sous chef there, and that's one of the biggest person that I want to see grow. You know, he's a super dedicated, loyal, and just hardworking person. It was like, well, what can I open that Brandon's comfortable running? You know, like, Chinese food. You know, Brandon grew up in North Carolina. You know, Chinese food isn't his forte, and he learned so much from me. But end of the day, like if I open a restaurant that he's unfamiliar with or flavor profile that he's only worked very little with, like that's not something that he would want to do. It's like, what would Brandon want to do? You know, he grew up around a lot of barbecue. And so that's kind of just how this project came to be.
So when I think barbecue, I think, you know, brisket, like ribs, you know, whatever, pulled pork, turkey.
Yeah.
I looked at your menu briefly, just like pictures, and it's not like it's barbecue, but it's not like what you'd think when you hear barbecue through an American or like, I should say a Caucasian lens.
Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up eating Cantonese style barbecue in Flushing, New York, you know, the roast ducks and the roast goose, the ducks, the crispy pork, the cha chao, like, pork. I missed that so much. And like, I was like, what if we combine Chinese style barbecue and then, but also smoking it like Southern style, because, you know, researching a lot of old school Cantonese style barbecue, it's all cooked over coal,
right?
Traditionally,
most Southeast Asia, like when you hear barbecue, it's like barbecue, like meat on sticks.
Yeah, so like, you know, we were like, oh, maybe we can incorporate smoke into all the traditional Chinatown style barbecue meats. So it's kind of a mixture of that. So, you know, we have our smoked duck and Chinese barbecue ribs, and
God, why you guys have to be closed?
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
That you can have, that you can have over rice or noodles, just like Chinatown, or you have, you know, our chopped pork sandwich, very Southern style, and then
so it's Asian or Chinese influenced cuts of meat with Chinese flavors with American approaches. Process.
Yeah, exactly. And then like some of the sides are, you know, like also like American Southern size, but has Chinese influences. Like corn pudding is such a big thing in the South. And so we made a chili crisp corn pudding with smoked sour cream. And then we did our collard greens, which is very big in the South, that we made with a hot pot base instead of just straightforward Southern style braised collard greens.
Yeah. And I see you're also serving it with rice, and you're serving it over like noodles too.
Yeah. Like wonton, like straight, like Chinatown style wonton, thin wonton noodles, which is
so,
very big.
Talk about unique selling proposition. Yeah. No one else is literally doing this. I mean, that I know of. I'm sure there's somebody else somewhere, maybe something similar. But like, but being truly unique, right?
And we didn't. Opening this place, we weren't thinking, oh, hey, like this is something. So this is something that Charleston is missing. That wasn't our first goal. We're just like, oh, this is something that sounds fun and delicious.
This is something also that we're missing.
Yeah. So like, we didn't open this for money. We didn't think, oh, this is going to be our money maker.
Pork rinds that I see on the website too.
Yeah. Oh, that's a very old picture though. Oh.
Yeah. We had pork rinds that was like dusted in like buffalo powder.
Dude, you guys have pork rinds I can buy off you? Yeah. Those don't have to be cooked, right?
No.
I love pork rinds.
I don't think we do though.
Damn.
Yeah, they came off, do we?
Yeah, I don't know if we have any left.
Oh, bummer. I figured it was worth a shot.
Yeah, that picture came from when we were still doing the pop-up for this.
Yeah.
And so, beautiful. Of course, like the menu has changed entirely, but like we haven't had any new photos taken.
So how are things going here? Is it like, it's a beautiful space, by the way.
Thank you.
I'm going to have to grab my camera before I leave and get some B-roll of this space too. How are things? Is it like gangbusters? Like the one thing that's different about this location with your other location is you guys, I mean, you're pulling from that following from your first, but it's a whole new type of food that you're not necessarily known for. So has it been a challenge?
It definitely was a challenge for back to house. Cause I was learning how to, you know, Brandon has some knowledge of how to use smokers. Cause he worked at Home Team Barbecue. And, you know, we reached out to our barbecue friends before we opened this restaurant and like and staged and figured out how to use our smokers more efficiently. But, you know, trying to figure out how to use smoking Chinese style meats was a huge challenge. I think we just got the ribs down to where we like it about like a month and a half ago, you know, or the pork belly was finally the way we like it like 2 weeks ago. So it's definitely a challenge, but it was nice because it's kind of learning again, you know, like Jackrabbit, Jackrabbit is great, and it's just food that I have cooked for, or flavors I have worked with, or techniques that I've worked with for a very long time. That was like, oh yeah, like I know how to do this now. But then the kind of learning stopped, and you know, the biggest part of cooking is that learning should never stop, right? So, cooking here and learning how to do barbecue was huge and was great. So I think we're finally at a good place with that. And a friend of house is great because we decided, you know, because also being the pandemic and staff being low, that we shifted King into a quick service instead of table side service because it was just necessary for the amount of staff that you can find.
Oh, okay. So yeah. I'm looking at that now. I honestly thought this was full service, and I'm seeing now pick up. I think that's a really smart move.
Yeah. It was brilliant.
Why?
Well, you know, just talking to first, most barbecue places are quick service because that, you know, most places aren't table size service or barbecue because it's more casual and barbecue is more casual. And then, yeah, it's just also finding, you know, Jackrabbit, we're very lucky to have the staff that we have. They're very good staff, you know, like working in New York, small restaurants, you know, the biggest part was that you had to turn and burn, right? But you wanted to provide it like excellent, excellent service. And so our service staff over there in front of the house are just really great servers. And so it was very hard to find a lot of great servers.
Yeah, I didn't want to have to find another entire front of the house crew for here with all the servers and with all the server assistants and like, no, thank you, please. And then at the same time too, like, you know, pandemic made customers tricky. And so you feel bad for the kids because they're the ones that have to be table side to sort of deal with some of the things that come through. And so it was like less time for them to interact with a customer, but less time for customers to interact with us. And you get so used to just being able to like walk in and get things. And like, I don't necessarily always want to wait for the rigmarole of someone coming and greeting me and then waiting for my water to be filled. And it just feels like it's more cohesive to everybody being happier customers and
workers.
Where
were your biggest expenses post 2022?
Yeah, my 78% labor costs.
Yeah. So I think that this is the new normal. This is like if I'm opening a restaurant tomorrow, I'm not going to have servers. 100% counter service or even doing QR codes on the tables and having every table like a specific table numbered. This just came in from this table and then you just run food and you have like one person on the floor, two people maybe during peak hours who's just constantly like floating, looking for people who need something.
And we have gotten... The crew we started with here, minus one, is still the same crew that we have now, and they're fantastic. And the most that I hear about it, other than food things, but like for front of the house things, is like, wow, your crew is so welcoming. And like, we just scored. So I do think we're still offering that same like very friendly vibe that we are known for in our restaurants. But yeah, people are freer to just sort of, it's just better for everyone. But so we're still trying to offer you the same like quality that if you have questions, like every single person can answer it. We all know what's in the sauces and things like that. So it's still not like necessarily high schoolers at a counter. Like we have these like industry vets doing this, but just in like, it just feels happier.
I think the biggest challenge of switching to table side service to quick service worrying about tips for front of house, right? Because that's what they live off of.
Right.
So we were always all worried that, oh yeah, like people are going to go up to the counter and order. I mean, we still bring the drinks and the food out, but they're going to feel like it's a lot less service so that maybe they feel, don't feel the need to tip, you know, 20% or whatever, you know, they want to tip. So, and we have run into that like a little bit, but.
Yeah, fewer people on staff, you can afford to pay them a little bit more. So can you balance it out? Can you close the gap?
I'm not sure. Back of the house here requires a lot of people.
Yes. Back of the house here is a beast because, you know, you're not just looking for line cooks anymore, right? Things aren't getting cooked to order. So the smokehouse requires a whole entire person just to be dedicated to the smokehouse because that's the biggest part of it.
Times that start like 3 a.m.
Actually, since we don't serve beef here, that we don't have to start till 7 a.m., which is great. Nothing gets cooked overnight, too, so there's never be any grease fires overnight. But yeah, so you know, you have one person just dedicated to the pit, you have to have a whole prep team just to besides the prep part of this whole entire restaurant is huge. Because outside of the prep part, you know, you're just kind of a lunch lady on the line because everything's ready and just scoop and go.
Yeah.
But yeah, and also, I mean, we pay everyone $5 an hour at all the restaurants. And I'm sorry if you're in a different city, you don't have to do that. But down here, it's a pretty good wage. But, you know, it's one thing that we would always evaluate like we can. But this restaurant is also steeply in debt. So like our bills every month, you know, like we're not quite where I want to. Like I think we are doing well and the kids' tips are like, well, for now. And
are you operating in the black with the restaurant? Is it like profitable out of the gates? A lot of people, it takes a year to get to the black.
Oh God, no. I mean, do you count like the debt that we have to pay off as being profitable or not?
I mean, profit goes towards paying off debt, right? So like you have your debt, you're covering your operational costs and you have enough money to pay off debt. Debt is being paid off, right?
Yes.
So I'd call that profitable because eventually, you know, that once the debt's gone, that's can go towards assets, right?
Then the other debt starts.
Then you do so the next project.
So then, yeah, we're not having to take out loans further to help us pay like payroll and things like that.
Do you have owner's pay? Are you able to pay yourselves with this restaurant?
No.
Not this restaurant. Jackrabbit, yes.
Okay.
Not here.
But yeah, not here. And probably not here for like
till the debt's paid off.
Yeah, for like the next 3 years, which I mean, Jackrabbit's only been open for 4. So I try not to think about that very much.
So anything that hasn't been discussed that you think needs to be discussed unique to your story, your ability, your strengths?
I think it'd be pretty.
Yeah, I think we've touched most of the
Can you believe it's been over 2 hours?
Oh my God. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, we're having fun.
Yeah. Our biggest part is Coronite, seriously, didn't get into this to make money. I think, like I always say, you shouldn't do this job to make money. It'd be stupid of you to think that, oh, I'll open a restaurant, I'll be a millionaire. No, this is the most, this industry costs so much to run and costs mental power and actual money to run. I think if this is your passion and you want to do this, then yeah, do it. That'd be great. And just got to make sure don't worry about the money. Treat your people well. That's where you should spend your money on. Don't worry about the money that's going in your own pocket because money comes and goes. If you're paying yourself, like we are paying ourselves a salary and we put a little bit of it away and that's when we're comfortable, then that's great. Like, don't worry about making millions of dollars. Like, open a restaurant that you're passionate about, make the food that you love to make, treat your people well, and everything else would just come.
Yeah.
You
know? So we're kind of in the conversation, we got to where we are today, but where do you think we're going? What are you doing to prepare for the future?
Well, I think our next big thing, moving Jackrabbit, solidifies Jackrabbit in its current spot. It probably would have closed in the next 3 years, whereas now it can go live up in its new fancy home once it's built for the next 15. Yeah. So okay. I feel like our flagship is finally going to be a flagship that can like have a thriving life.
Yeah. We're hoping.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And then after that, I don't know. It's like.
Well, I don't know. For us, we're hoping, pay off the debt for King and then pay off the debt for the new Jackrabbit. And we're hoping, we get to the point where we're very busy and that we honestly want to pay our people more because I think they all deserve more money. Mm-hmm. But, right now we're poor. We can't afford it.
We built King with the thought that Jackrabbit could probably never be duplicated because it is so, it's just very intensive all around. But, King is meant to be replicated. So maybe like in a couple of years, I don't know. I think we're still waiting for somebody to approach us. And there has been like a little bit of interest of like where to open another King baby, but like we kind of haven't figured that out yet. But, we have the talent and I'm always thinking about which managers we would move to be the starting team at like King Barbecue Austin or King Barbecue Buffalo.
Or, Brandon Olson, his next move is how do we get him to where I am?
Hmm.
Or how do I get him out of the kitchen?
I think that's the constant move is how do I replace myself with other people?
Just so he doesn't have to hustle anymore.
Right. For sure. So what do you think, the mission statement is to inspire, empower, and transform the industry. What do you think we need to be intentional about in terms of transforming the industry so we can get the word out there and get people thinking the same way? What has to change?
I think it's insane to me sometimes how little, this goes back to how little people pay their staff, especially people with way more money than we have, not paying their staff a livable wage, especially back at the house. Front of house will always earn their tips, but back at the house it's very hard. Like our staff, they'll work a whole entire 45-hour week and they probably earn the same as much money as a front of house employee for like two, three days. So people need to pay their staff well, but people who are dining at a restaurant need to realize that kitchen or just restaurant people need to make a living as well. They need to make a livable wage. And because of that, you can't always think that food is not going to be cheap ever again.
Right.
Hamburgers aren't going to cost 50 cents anymore or like whatever the price was. you know, like even 5 years ago, you know. So,
so
like,
what do we have to do? How do we get there?
I think it feels like too big a question. And I honestly don't know, because I'm in a place where I feel like we are starting to see the death of all the mom and pop mid-level restaurants that were going to be high end for people that can afford it, or fast food for big conglomerates that can afford it. Because, like, knowing, like, I would love to pay everybody in the kitchen at least $10 more than they're making currently. But, like, seeing how we would be out of business within, like, a couple of months if that was the case, I haven't at all figured it out yet. And you know the tipping structure is unfair, but that's what the kids survive on. That's the reason that they're doing this job, is that they can make good money doing it. You know, I mean, putting credit card fees back on the customer, and it lets us breathe again, but then that makes their checks so much more expensive. It is expensive to eat out nowadays. Like, Schwein, I barely do, because, you know, we don't have any more money than anybody else, and, like, you have to pick and choose where you spend that money. So we are very grateful that people so often choose to spend it with us, but how long can this last for? So I don't have any answers.
I mean, it's.
Wow.
I mean, I think it's a combination of educating the consumer, but absolutely, also we have to start lifting each other up and educating each other. And I think it's going to be, to your point, you're seeing the small mom and pops go away, but I do think that there's plenty of market available for, like, the $1 billion restaurant groups that are out there, or like the $100 million restaurant groups that are out there. And I think we need to meet somewhere in the middle of seeing more 20 unit operators, like, that are hyper local, you know, where they might have like 20 or 15 concepts in a region and they own that region, and injecting things like conscious capitalism and like all these different things. But I think that there is a movement of conscious capitalism. Information is flowing more freely today than ever before. And I think at the end of the day, people realize when they put their money someplace, like, the best part about spending money is when you know that somebody, like it's always been about the restaurant owner being seen by the guest, but now the guest is being seen by the restaurant because they're supporting the business. And that feels good. Just like it feels good to feed somebody and to see that they approve of your meal, like, to have somebody say, hey, yeah, I'm going to pay you another 20% more than I could if I went to a chain. But, like, you seeing them and saying, yeah, thank you. And, like, that's conscious capitalism. It's feeling good for when you spend your money, yeah, not on tangible things, like insignificant things like cars and clothes, but, like, on relationships.
Yeah. And I think it takes people like Irene Lee and to, like, figure out a lot of the nitty gritty things and kind of share their knowledge via, you know, people like you and people like us who have been through a lot of stuff, you know, pandemic or whatever, and to, again, pass on that knowledge to someone else, and how to be more successful, either as in food cost, labor cost, or
also how to build a better team. Too, like, there's always like people will always throw numbers at us that we did this on a Friday or this and that, and I don't know how much of it is real and how much isn't, but it's such a secretive thing that I feel like, yeah, the whole industry could just stand to be, like, a little bit more.
We will all go open further together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I've, like, that's the thing. I don't mind telling you any of my numbers, because it should be transparent. And I think something that Move It Forward too, and I've always thought this, like, I think it's a great place to work in restaurants. You know, front of the house, but you, like, make a ton of money. You get to eat and drink and meet interesting people. And if you're a social person, like, I've always loved this industry. It's how I, you know, like, funneled my book career all those years.
But yeah,
I think it needs to be respected more as well. Just sort of by everybody, you know, like, everybody is always like, oh, well, you working in a restaurant, what are you going to do? Like, what are you trying to do instead of that?
Oh,
like, yeah, why can't it just be that, like, this is my job and I love it.
Right. A shift in culture, you know. We're gonna do it for sure, and this has been a lot of fun. I'm gonna ask a few more closing questions and we can wrap it up. Thank you so much for the great conversation today.
Yeah,
thank you for having us.
Of course, the pleasure is mine. What is one thing about your business, a value, a process, a system that's truly unstoppable?
For the first day that we came to the United States, which is September 16th, 1996, the first thing my mom has told me was that you're always going to have to work twice as hard as everyone else because you're an immigrant to get the same exact results. So I think Corey have the same work value as I do, and all our staff have the same value as we do, is that we have one speed and one speed only. It's just going. Yeah. Like, there's nothing that stops us from achieving the next goal. And I think that's our our collective work ethics is what keeps us moving forward and like hired and like a lot of, and then keep going every day.
Also, we like a good theme. Themes are unstoppable in our restaurants. It used to be sweatpants Sundays when we worked brunch. Every staff party has a theme. We like good dress-up themes.
I think
also I don't know. I was trying to make it lighter too. It's something very unique to us. I don't know any other restaurants that like play around with themes quite so much.
Yeah, I think I think people shouldn't. You know what makes it, what makes a restaurant thrive? What makes you unique? What makes you stand out? Is that you shouldn't be worried about being quirky.
Yeah,
shouldn't be worried about being quirky and weird and doing what you love to do.
Yeah,
like that's what makes you unstoppable.
I think that's why I love this industry so much, is because people aren't afraid to be themselves. Yeah. In corporate America, there's like this quote professionalism, and I think I'm not saying like don't treat people well, don't be rude, but like what is professionalism? It's the definition is to do a job really well. Yeah. You can do your job really well, but we take it out of context and it means act a certain way to get along with a lot of different types of people.
Yeah.
And no thank you. No. Like, I'm going to be who I am, and if you're not for me, then there's another place for you to work.
No, Jack Rabbit didn't get to where it is because we made, you know, regular Chinese food. You know?
Well, and I always stand on the platform that says, I don't think the customer is always right. I'm sorry, if you're being rude to my people, you are not right in that, you know? And right. I tell that to the kids, like, this is not a place where you have to take shit. This is our house. And if someone is, like, treating you in a way that you don't like, go get your manager,
right.
You know? Like, this is, like, I don't know. I don't think the customer is always right.
There's a host-guest dance. And I think the hospitality industry is really great at being hosts, but the guests have forgotten how to be a guest.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, we're not servants.
Yeah. So if the mission statement, again, is to inspire, empower, and transform the industry, how have you personally transformed? Who are the man and woman you are today versus the man and woman you were when you first got started?
Oh, yes. Like undescribable. I used to not be able to make a decision without asking 15 other people if it was the right decision first. Yeah. And granted, I still get lots of advice, but I really like the way this has kind of turned me into a hardened hardened soul. But at the same time, I don't know. There isn't anything I feel like I can't do anymore. Like, I have no fear anymore.
Wow.
Wow. It's true.
Is fearless.
I'm fearless.
Start calling this restaurant Fearless.
Restaurant number three.
Is that a Jet Li movie? It took me, when I first started cooking, there's no way I could have led anything. In other words, I couldn't lead people. I couldn't lead a restaurant. Like, I feel like this, having gone through, you know, opening the food truck, doing the pop-ups, hiring people and learning how to talk to and lead people, it really made me a way better leader than what I was before. Like we were talking about patience before, like, the amount of people that, you know, that we now have working under us, that has, everyone has their own needs and questions and concerns. It takes a lot to kind of deal with every single one, every single person in their own specific way. Mm. So I think it taught me a lot to how to be a leader, how to lead people well.
All right, this next one is a toughie. So ears open.
These have all been toughies.
Wait until you get this next one. Mm-hmm. If you got the news, you'd be leaving this world tomorrow. All the memories of you, your work, and your restaurants would be lost with your departure, with the exception of three pieces of wisdom that you could leave behind for the good of humanity and your legacy. What are those three pieces of wisdom?
Oh, my God.
Three pieces?
Three pieces.
Don't open a restaurant.
That's a great one.
At the end of the day, it's just food.
One.
Yeah. I think this is something that Sean Brock said, and is a very smart thing. Like, make sure you help yourself before you can help anyone else.
Yes. Two.
Promote from within.
Three.
Terrible.
I mean, I think create opportunity for others. You know?
I like it.
And that was a big part of today's conversation. Honestly, that's what I was thinking. Sometimes I have to help people come up with the three because I listen. I'm like, there's definitely a trend and I can help them find the words. Yeah. But that is for sure something. It's all about creating opportunity for others.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I think that's what I like best about this.
Pay it forward.
Is seeing everybody kind of grow and knowing we had a tiny part in that.
So I found you because Irene Lee said, you got to talk to my friends down in Charleston. Who do you respect and admire? People who are loved, who take care of their staff, and who are also making money and can teach us on how to be fiscally responsible and secure.
I mean, Marijuana and Molly out of the Chai Penny Restaurant Group in Asheville, I think we say all the time that, you know, they're our mom and pop restaurant that we look at, and they're probably 10 years further out than we are, but it kind of gives me hope, and they'll happily tell you all the mistakes that they've made and that they've only kind of gotten ahead through making a bunch of mistakes.
Yeah, they have to. They've had successes and failures and hard decisions to make throughout their whole entire career, and they're still only just growing as well.
Yeah, and they I think have just sort of taken it to the next level. That now they're soon going to have.
How far
is
Asheville from here? Like 5 miles? 4 hours? No,
four and a half? Hours?
Yeah, I think they can do it in the next 24 hours.
I don't know, maybe. We can ask them.
Yeah. If not, we can always come back.
We can ask them.
I am looking for an excuse to go to Asheville. I will head there right now.
Great people to
have inspired us the entire way.
That's the only reason why we hired CDCs, because of Marijuana, and the only reason why we opened more projects.
Which last time we saw them, we were like, thanks a lot. You know what else people could have done if we didn't open another restaurant? Go get other jobs.
And how can we connect with you? If we really enjoyed today's conversation, maybe we have a follow-up conversation we would like to have with you. Maybe we are in your area and we're aspiring to own our own place someday. We want to come work and learn from you.
Yeah, well, come, yeah, visit us at Jackrabbit or King Barbecue, or yeah, hit us up at hello@jackrabbitphilly.com or hello@kingbarbecue.com.
That's not the correct email address. It is hello@eatkingbarbecue.com. King Barbecue was taken.
Well done. I'm backing them up. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you much.
Thank you for having us.
The pleasure was mine. I'm just a guy who asks questions. You make what I do possible. So thank you. And there is no questioning. You are unstoppable.
Wow.
Wow.
Thank you.
Thank you. Cheers.
Cheers.
There's another episode wrapped up here today at Restaurant Unstoppable. Special thanks to our guests, Shui and Corey Wong, for coming on and sharing their story. And I think the thing that really kind of, you know, shook me today is the success these guys had, you know, scaling their first restaurant, Jackrabbit Philly, having, I mean, doing $2.2 million in sales. And I think they said they were doing like 11 or 15%. I can't remember what percent they said they were making, but it's just all of a sudden, like, the cost of goods just start going through the roof. The cost of labor starts going through the roof. And it's getting harder and harder for these small, independent mom and pops to make it with the increase in costs and the consumer just not really understanding why costs are going up. And I think it's just so important that if we're going to keep the independent operator relevant moving into the future, we have to educate the consumer. We have to create this movement, a shift in consumer behavior, conscious capitalism. And I don't know. I just feel like I hope I'm encouraging you to get the word out and to not be afraid of the consumer, but to develop a relationship with the consumer, to educate the consumer. And I think if we all start doing this, we can make the needle move. And, you know, awesome stuff came out of today's conversation. Lots of vulnerability, lots of transparency. So thank you so much, Shui and Corey, for coming on. And I thank you, Irene Lee, for putting these folks on my radar. And if you're enjoying this podcast and you want more content just like this, we need your support. Please share this podcast with everybody and anyone you know aspiring to be great in the industry. Give me some of those 5-star reviews. That really helps on iTunes and Spotify. And let me know if you left a review. I'll screenshot it and I'll share it. And anyway, those reviews really help with our ranking. And then lastly, the best way to support this mission is to join Restaurant Unstoppable.
community and network. We have three tiers. You can get ad-free content. We have a whole content library over at restaurantunstoppable.com where you can filter through and be more intentional with your listening. And then there's the live event. So come hang out. I can't wait to meet you. We can't say goodbye without saying thank you to Jared Parisi with the Sumadre Podcast for your copyright and editing. And thank you, Callan Miola, our community manager, crushing it. We're going further together. I can't wait to see what happens next. That's it for today. Until next time, peace out.